to order. Thank you, everyone, for being here. This is, I'll call the conference committee together for House File 392. And I thought the first thing we could do is run through the quick introduction so everybody knows who everybody else is and or has tried to forget. And so we want to do, you know, the front row of staff and revenue and everybody at the table. So maybe we can just start with Ms. Templin.
Hi, I'm Ms. Templin. I'm non-partisan people staff.
Nina Manzi, House Research. I work on the individual income tax.
Joel Michael, House Research.
Steve Hines, House Research.
Karen Baker, House Research. Kathy Schill, House Research.
Al Junkie from Candioy County.
I'm Randy Demmer from Dodge County and part of Olmsted County, District 29A.
Lyle Coonan, District 20B, Chippewa County, Renville County, Eastern Yellow Medicine County.
Paul Markwart, District 9B, all of Wilkin and Traverse County and parts of Clay and Becker County, and we're awful wet in my area right now.
We're thinking of Representative Markwart, and we're glad to see Senator Scoies making his way in. I'm Alan Shepke, I represent Bloomington, and nice to be with you again, Chair Bach.
Tom Bach, Senate District 6, which is most of the Arrowhead region, and we still have snow on the ground, and we're getting some more today.
Rod Scoies, Senate District 2, and my son, I talked to him last night, and he said the water in the Clearwater River is touching our bridge, so a lot of water.
Rick Rolstein from Senate District 17, which is all of Chisago and most of Isanti and part of Anoka County.
State Senator Scott Dibble. My district is almost completely covered by Green Acres. Southwest Minneapolis, downtown Minneapolis.
Joanne Zoff from Senate Council.
Mark Hasty from Senate Council.
Susan Von Rush with San Francisco staff.
She says no. Okay. Is there anybody else who wants to move in there that we should find? Well, Julie's right there. So, Julie, you want folks to know who you are there?
Stand up. We might be on TV. Your mother's here.
I'm the legislative assistant for Senator Bach.
Okay, thank you, Julie. And we've got one more senator to introduce. Senator Bach was just trying to make the minority senators move out of this building, and I don't know, Senator Olstein wanted him to go to the Ford building. Welcome, Senator Vandeveer. Can you tell us who you are and where you represent? Just getting started.
Lee Vandeveer, Forest Lake, first term state senator, 5 terms in the House. Represent northern Washington County and northeastern Anoka County.
Great. Well, thank you all. And I want to first apologize for the room. Ms. Carlton Walworth got the biggest room she could get. As you know, we're running up on policy deadlines, and both the House and Senate, all the big rooms are taken. So we're putting pressure on Chris over here to see if they can get us not as tight of a room for tomorrow, unless we get done tonight, Senator Bach, which I think we could get done tonight, Senator Bach.
Okay, I'm just wondering, you'll notice the makeup of the Senate Conference Committee has inner city, Minneapolis, ex-urban, rural. I'm just wondering, the House side seems a little slanted rural. But
you mean with Lincheski?
I just noticed that.
Senator Bach, the Senate members, the House members in both parties, no matter where they reside, understand that federal conformity has to get done immediately. All of it. And so beyond that, if there are other issues, I have incredible confidence in the House conferees to come out with a good position on those issues.
Madam Chair, if somehow this committee comes to some resolve and signs a conference committee report and there's some version of a Green Acres provision in here, because this is a House file, will the House take credit for resolving kind of the Green Acres angst that's out there just because it happens to be a House file? They send out letters to the paper saying the House fixed this. prior to the plowing.
Well, I'll ask the other House conference what they'll do. I won't. They'll send your box fix it. How's that? So, I don't know. What time junkie is that what you do?
Well, since I do the Outstate News, read every paper every day around the state. The only people I've seen take credit so far are senators, particularly Senator Scoy, who's got columns and half the papers out there. Just for the
record. Senator Bach, we brought our own senator to the conference committee this time. I think he just got a play for that. Everyone has to be in the Senate to understand how that works. I think this will be a great group of people, and we're kidding around, but both of these issues are very serious issues, and we need them both resolved. So we want to get full conformity absolutely as quickly as we can, and we want to solve the Green Acres issues. And Senator Bach and I have talked about that, and I think we're both committed to doing that. So we want to just get started and get moving on that. I thought we would start with Ms. Manzi and Mr. Michael. I believe it would be the right people to walk through the, or maybe Ms. Manzi right here. Yeah. And did Ms. Von Marsh want to join? I'm not sure who's going to. Mr. Hastings, please. Yes. So we're going to go through the federal conformity. Senator Bach and I talked about this a little bit last night. We'd like to get through that. We want to hear from the Department of Revenue. Who are these folks who the Senate has not done conformity on that are being affected? Then we'd like to get through Green Acres. So we're going to ask, again, both sides here to walk through the Green Acres, and we'd like to get that all done today as quickly as we can. And then we'd like to begin negotiations today, as we are under the gun on both of these. I think that we need to take a break about four. We have two senators who have to have bills up in various places, so we're gonna recess and come back as soon as they can get their bills through their committees, and then we'll just keep going. So people who want to get a bite to eat should do that when we take that break, wherever they can around here. I do want to just, before we start with staff here, is just say that I think there's only Senator Osteen who has not had the pleasure of being a House member. Do you have any insights you want to provide for us on that?
I was so grateful when Representative Kalin ran for the House. I ran for the Senate.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. So, where should we start? Ms. Manzi, please. Well, we've got this in our folders, I believe. If you can direct us to what we're looking at.
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, Nina Manzi, House Research. Mr. Hastie and I put together something that's a little bit different from the standard side-by-side. It's like this. And rather than going through section by section, it sort of hits the main topics inside of federal conformity and indicates what the two bills do on those topics. The first topic is the date that we're updating to the federal code to, and the House is updating to all federal changes through December 31st, 2008. After that, the summary list of the major bills we're updating to. These are all the federal bills that have been enacted since we adjourned last session, with the exception of the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, which was enacted after House File 392 passed the House floor.
Thank you. And can I just say, I think because we really do want to try to get this done as quickly as we can, we're going to pass all the things that we're in agreement on, and I know others who may be interested in them, but we're going to skip over them and just get to where we disagree. So, please, yes. Welcome.
My name is Ed Mark Hasty with Senate Counsel, Madam Chair, and members of the Conference Committee. We agree with the dates here. We disagree with the dates. It's June 17th is the date that the Senate conforms to. However, on the other provisions, the HEAL Earnings Assistance and Tax Relief Act, we do agree with the House, we conform to that. On the Housing Assistance Tax Act, there are actually three sections which we conform to, one of them which was not listed here, sections 3012, 3023, and I should add section 3022, paragraph 8, if you add that to that section. So those are what we do conform to, and we don't conform to the rest of the Housing Assistance Tax Act. The Senate version does not conform to the Heartland Habitat Harvest and Horticultural Act, enacted June 18th. And for the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, we conform to Division C, Sections 202, 203, and 204, but none of the rest of the sections of that act.
next section in the summary hits the high points of the federal law changes. I'm not going to go through them. It's on pages 1, 2, 3, and 4. So these bullet points list all the items that directly affect Minnesota taxpayers that were contained in those four pieces of federal legislation enacted since the end of last session. The bottom of page 4 is the heading for major federal changes that we're not conforming to that will require additions on the Minnesota individual income tax return. Both the House and the Senate will require an addition for the new additional amount added to the standard deduction for property taxes. And then moving to the top of page 5, both in the House and the Senate are going to require an addition for the tuition expense deduction. So we're disallowing that new extension of that item that the federal government enacted. The House requires an addition for the enhanced deduction of contributions of computers. This follows along with what we did last year regarding the same deduction, which has since been extended by the federal government. And then we require an addition for the extension of additional subpart F income exclusion. And the Department of Revenue has pointed out that there's a technical error on our language on that item that would need to be corrected in a conference committee report if this were to be adopted.
Madam Chair, members, I'll just highlight the things I guess that the Senate does not conform to. And if you go down to page 5 where Ms. Manzi left off there, starting with the extension of the special rule for contribution of conservation property, you'll see that there are several items there which would require additions on the Minnesota return if we do not conform to them. And so I don't know if you want me to go through all of them individually or not, but they're listed all the way down on page 5 and at the top of page 6 as well. So they would require additions on the Minnesota return. There are also, on page 6, we have major federal changes not conform to that require subtractions on the Minnesota return. And there are actually three of them. I believe the senators in their packet was a third one, which is not listed there, requiring non-qualified deferred compensation of certain taxpayers to be included in taxable income. So there are three subtractions that would be required on the Minnesota return on the Senate version. And then the next section are major federal changes not conformed to that would require compliance with previous federal law. And those would include, I'll highlight a couple of those, the allowing like kind of exchange treatment for shares in mutual ditch reservoir irrigation companies, the real estate investment trust treatment, changes to the Gulf Opportunity Zone losses. And I think the major provision there is the next section, which are many changes to depreciation for depreciation expensing, many business expenses there. And moving over to page 7, the top here on the Senate, now, the last issue there is changes providing more generous expensing and depreciation for certain federally declared disaster areas. The next section is our major federal changes not conformed to that would require a recalculation of adjusted gross income for state tax. And as you can see, there are three provisions that would require that as well. The next piece there is the revenue offset for cost of conformity. And maybe Ms. Manzi can talk about that first for the House side.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the consequence of the House conforming to all the things that the Senate did not conform to is that the bill has a net cost in the first biennium, and that is paid for through delaying payment of corporate tax refunds from fiscal 9 to fiscal 10. The Department of Revenue has estimated for us that there will be adequate refunds to cover the shortfall in fiscal 9, and then the same thing happens again from fiscal 11 to fiscal 12. And since the revenue raisers in the federal bills tend to be more ongoing in nature than the cost items, in years after that, the bill is in balance and wouldn't need anything like that, even if we budgeted beyond the 4 years going forward.
Madam Chair, members, as you can see, for the revenue offset, we do not have a provision in that because our bill, the bill that is in our version, does not have any cost to the general fund, so therefore there's no revenue offset required.
final section titled Other, and an amendment added on the floor in the House is a provision prohibiting the governor from appointing as Commissioner of Revenue an individual who's been convicted of a criminal violation of federal or state tax or revenue law, has failed to file an income tax return within a year of its due date, or has unpaid federal, state, or local taxes for a prior tax year at the time the appointment is announced.
Madam Chair, members of the Senate did not adopt that amendment.
Madam Chair, members, both the House and the Senate have a provision recommended by the Department of Revenue on withholding of differential pay for people who are called to active service. There have been federal changes to the definition of wages as far as withholding is goes relating to these wage differentials, and the department has suggested a temporary change to how we administer this to sort of feather into have the new federal rules on this.
Madam Chair, members, we have the same provision in our bills.
Okay. Thank you so much. Well, I just want to ask, I want to make sure, is your name Steve?
Yes.
Okay, I don't want to mispronounce it each time. I wasn't sure the case. So thank you, Mr. Casey, and thank you, Nancy. And I think, looking at the clock here, because we want to break at about 4. So I think we just clicked on the walk through on the conformity. This is here from the Department of Revenue, from Ms. Cadoon. The House, of course, was conformed to all these items, and so we kind of know why we're formed. But we would like the Department of Revenue to tell all the companies what are these groups of people that are not being conformed to, and what is the effect for all these tax filers, so we can just think about it rather than in a detailed way here. And who are we talking about in all these provisions? And maybe Ms. Cadoon could walk through that, and we could have some discussion, and we could break. And start Green Acres after the break. So if we could get your federal conformity before the break, that would be just great. So are there questions? Can just go to Ms. Cadoon.
Okay, welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I could just take a few minutes just talking about kind of the reality of non-compliance that the Department of Revenue is right now experiencing and taxpayers due to not complying with federal conformity updates at this point. As you know, Minnesota's individual income tax and corporate franchise tax are obviously closely linked to the federal definitions. The more we deviate from those definitions, the more complex and burdensome compliance with our tax laws become. Because of the increased complexity due to non-compliance, the result is more mistakes and returns, increased number of returns being rejected, errors that are being experienced from the software vendors with taxpayers, and also increased number of complaints. The Department of Revenue has been experiencing about 50 to 60 calls a day from taxpayers with federal conformity issues. That was a few weeks ago. Currently, it's running about more like 20 a day. We expect to have an uptick on that again as close as we get to the end of the filing season. We're also experiencing increased number of returns being rejected from e-filing due to the errors resulting from federal conformity. We're experiencing some issues in working with software vendors because there's obviously it's fairly complex when they're trying to adopt the non-conformity with the federal law. So we are experiencing kind of an uptick in those errors as well. I did want to mention what you'd asked regarding kind of the examples for individual taxpayers. If you look through the whole list of federal conformity items, many of them have minimal or negligible of dollars. There's a few items with a larger dollar amount, but the impact, though they may be small dollar-wise, the impact on individual taxpayers and businesses can be substantial, both in the time trying to comply with the law as well as impact on their taxes, obviously. Just if I could give two examples of kind of the increased complexity. One relates to the provision dealing with the IRA distribution for individuals who are 70 and a half and older, who are allowed to do a distribution directly from their IRA to a qualified charity. This provision impacts estimated less than 3,000 taxpayers, and it would be for conformity for 2008 and 2009. We just recently received a letter of complaint from an individual who had done a directed distribution from their IRA of $660, so we're not necessarily dealing with wealthy taxpayers here. It really is a range of the income deciles that take advantage of this distribution. They did a year-end distribution directly to their church of $660. This was obviously a tax-free distribution under federal law. When they went to do their Minnesota calculation, it obviously then had potential tax consequences in Minnesota. The taxpayer would then require to recalculate their adjusted federal gross income for Minnesota's tax purposes to add this distribution from their IRA to their income. What this means for some taxpayers is because of this adjustment to gross income, it may impact other tax provisions, such as Social Security. They might result in more Social Security income being subject to tax in Minnesota, and it can also impact some other deductions, such as the medical expense deduction due to the income phase-out. For this individual, he also, because they had a glitch in the software that he was using, it did not allow him to utilize the Minnesota charitable deduction. He was a non-itemizer, so he could have taken advantage of at least half of that donation could have been deducted under for the charitable donation under Minnesota law. Working with the software vendor to fix that glitch in the software. But so that individual would not be able to fully offset their that charitable donation. So that was just one complaint that we received for that provision. Another provision, if I could highlight, relates to a provision that was part of the first Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008. In that bill, they had numerous provisions dealing with accelerated business expensing and depreciation, really with the idea they were trying to jumpstart the economy, obviously at that point, to encourage businesses to make improvements. And also to provide some tax breaks during these tough economic times. One provision deals with allowing retail and restaurant businesses for certain property purchases or improvements to take a straight line depreciation over 15 years versus 39 years, which would be current law. What this would mean, for example, for a small restaurant owner is they would need now to keep two separate, if you don't conform to this, they would need to keep two separate set of books for that asset for over 39 years. And it's not just for that asset. What would happen is this small business would now need to recalculate their federal taxable income for Minnesota purposes, not just for this year, but for the life of the asset. So for 39 years, they'd have to recalculate their taxable income for Minnesota. So obviously, this has ongoing implications for these small business owners. I just want to finish with saying at this point in the tax season, we've had about 1.4 million taxpayers have filed and had their returns processed. That's about approximately 56% of the returns that we would expect based on last year's numbers, which was 2.6 million. Many of those impacted by federal conformity issues, however, probably would be more apt to hold off on filing because if you may be told by their tax preparer, as well as if they looked online, that in past years we have seen some more federal conformity, so it's kind of basically tells them to stay tuned that there might be some action on federal conformity. So we estimate that those that are impacted on federal conformity issues are probably more apt to have held off and not filed yet. So we still believe there's a benefit to passing federal conformity. Even though it's late in the filing season, there would be some benefits. It would still provide some clarity and reduce complexity and confusion for those taxpayers who have not filed. It also lessen the need for those taxpayers to file another return if we really get some clarity on this fairly soon. I don't know if you had more questions. I certainly have myself and Mark Peterson's office here to answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Cadoon, do I remember in the governor's supplemental budget, did he do the Section 179 conformity in the supplemental?
He proposed it as well in his first budget announcement, and then after the federal passed their most recent federal stimulus bill, he also wanted to add as well.
So do you remember what that cost, the total?
For the total federal conformity, I don't remember it off the top.
On the 179
expense. For the supplemental, for the additional, was I know $3 million. I looked it up. I do have those numbers.
Ms. Cadoon, no, and this isn't addressed on either side, but Ms. Cadoon, maybe Ms. Templin may be able to tell us. I probably need to give her a minute, but I think what happened, maybe while she's looking, in addition to the fact that the legislature, under both Republican and Democrats being the majority, has not conformed to Section 179. Obama has now ramped that up a little bit, so it gets a little more expensive. Ms. Cadoon?
Madam Chair, in the governor's recommendation was for property plat placed in service for 2009, and I think it was 2010, if I remember very correctly. Okay. So it wasn't impacting this current filing season.
Ms. Cadoon, can you tell Senator Bach's question? Is the last time we got to conformity on this was 2005? Is that right? And then in 06, 07, 08, and 09, you know, both parties have chosen not to do this, but I think the governor is now looking to do it, but not in either the House or Senate version of this bill that we have today, and then Obama is doing it as well. I don't know if someone can tell us definitively. Was 2005 the last year Minnesota did it? Anybody know? Silence. We'll find out later.
Yes.
Mr. Michael says yes, and Ms. Manzi says yes. So I think 2005. Chair Bach.
So, Madam Chair, I've always been a little reluctant to delay corporate tax refunds to do this conformity, which was the House's approach. How would the governor feel about using some of the money that, as a result of the federal money coming in now, I think we have an unrestricted fund balance of about $236 million on June 30th. How would the governor feel about using, rather than delaying corporate tax refunds as the House proposes, actually using some of that unrestricted fund balance that we have there?
Assistant Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, at this point, this has not been run by the governor, so I have no idea what his response would be. I do know for the corporate refund idea that had been run by him, and he thought that was something that would be acceptable. Department of Finance has said it was workable. The business community has typically been very strong on federal conformity, and it was my understanding that they were fine with the corporate refund delay. So I don't know the response to your direct question, though.
I'm sure I think it would be helpful if you could find that out.
Yes, Ms. Cadoon, and maybe, I don't know, I saw the commissioner earlier this morning, and maybe you guys could, let's see here. Hi, Commissioner. Come on in.
I'm out there. I'm trying to avoid
the bees. Will you quit calling the governor to ask him if he'd be okay with a little bit less of what he's got going so he can buy full conformity? Did you catch any of that?
Madam Chair, I did catch under box inquiry. And I can try to find that out before you reconvene. I'm not sure that's going to be 5 o'clock or 5:30. I can try to run that by Commissioner Hanson and the governor's office to see what their initial first flush response would be.
That would be great, I think.
Yes. I don't think we have to know that today. I think it's unlikely we'd wrap this up tonight, but we've got a dinner date. You can see I don't skip meals, so I...
Senator Bach, when are we wrapping this up? I think we agreed. I think we agreed we're going to pass it every other day.
We have rules on that?
Yeah, that was that phone call yesterday.
I'm just kind of curious about that, because I think if we're going to do conformity, it just seems to me we have some money sitting in the bottom line in this biennium. We've got to spend this year's money maybe rather than next year's money. We have enough problems in 10 and 11 already without adding to it.
Mr. It would be good, though, if you could, the sooner you could get that information, the better. I'll just speak to the Senate conference to let you know the House's thought on this. You know, we went through this process trying to get to full conformity and heard, you know, the department's proposal here to do partial, and just basically thought it was a waste of time to do partial where you're going through this process to get a bill signed. You're not permanently conforming to lots and lots of provisions. You're not passing on tons of tax relief to a May bill that may or may not get signed. So we had a number of meetings bipartisanly to try to think through how could we get the revenue raisers in the bill, throw the money from the future back into the current so that the governor could not be signing a tax increase. So really that was sort of the strategy here. Commissioner Innes and Assistant Commissioner Cadoon worked hard to secure that the governor could be okay with that, and we worked with the business community here that they could be okay with that because they're some of the beneficiaries of these provisions. And we had a lot of testimony. Maybe it would be helpful for Assistant Commissioner Cadoon to let the Senate conferees know what kind of delays we were looking at. It was very short-term for not very many businesses. Now, we have a current, is it 60-day or 90-day, and we've missed that a little. But so we thought we were coming up with a political solution to assist a lot of Minnesota taxpayers in a way that the governor could sign it. So we felt to go through the conformity partially, not even to deal with all these IRA contributors, not help the veterans who are trying to get their working family credit, not help, you know, all the places you guys have an empty box and we have a full box. We just didn't think it was worth it to kind of, you know, move everything through the House floor and then kind of get almost nothing. So that's where we were going. So if we could just take a minute to have Ms. Cadoon talk about how the delay mechanism of the corporate refund would work. And we did take testimony from the business community on that and had conversations, and they felt comfortable with it. So, Ms. Cadoon, can you just explain that a little bit for Senate conferees?
Madam Chair, members, for the corporate delay, it was forecasted for corporate tax refunds that for April, May, and June, they'd be about $30 million. So what the Department of Revenue would expect that we would do, we'd probably start holding refunds on May 1st just to make sure, because we don't know exactly when these will come in, to make sure that we'd be able to meet that $15 million target. The goal, obviously, would be to kind of try, hopefully do it more on a first-in, first-out basis. So we could minimize the delay to any corporate filer, as well as to minimize any interest accrual that might occur. So that's how we would plan on implementing that.
Ms. Cadoon, and maybe if you don't know this, maybe somebody around the table does. Is there any precedent? Has the legislature ever delayed corporate refunds before as a way to pay for something?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, we haven't delayed corporate refunds as far as I know. We did a similar tool when we delayed the capital equipment rebates, and that was back in 2003, I believe.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, that wasn't a good idea either. That one, if I remember, it was about $50 million. Yep. Is my memory correct on that?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Bach.
Yes, sir.
We would stipulate that's not an ideal solution. Delaying the capital refund was not an ideal solution. Delaying the corporate refund is not an ideal solution. But we put a really high value on federal conformity. And I think Beth probably talked about it a little bit. But, you know, the further we get removed from federal conformity, we undermine compliance, we undermine tax administration, we undermine revenue collection. And it's a taxpayer-friendly thing to do. And even though some of the solutions and some of the ways of funding the federal conformity is less than ideal, it's still, we think, on balance, it's a net benefit for taxpayers, a net benefit for tax system, and it really does enhance overall systemic which is one of the Department of Revenue's number one goals.
Now, Chair, Mr. Michael, do you ever remember delaying corporate tax refunds before?
Mr. Michael.
Delaying any refunds other than the capital equipment one that we did a couple years ago?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I cannot remember any time when we've held corporate or individual income tax refunds. I don't know, other states have done that and, in fact, maybe doing it now, but we've generally been successful in avoiding that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, in dreaming about this conference committee and getting an opportunity to get together with you, I was thinking about the budget solution that Senator Cohn is dealing with, and maybe if we delayed everybody's refunds by about 2 years, we could solve this whole problem. Commissioner, what do you think of that?
Madam Chair,
am I the only one that thought of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I think that the solution that the House has come up with and the governor has agreed is an acceptable way of funding the federal conformity is a very surgical, short-term way of funding the federal conformity. Now, granted, we may be setting some sort of limited precedent, but I still think the value of doing that outweighs any kind of precedent we may be setting. I trust the committee, I trust the tax committees not to use this precedent for any, you know, funding priority that they think is of high value. I just think that this is a very surgical way. Some of the primary beneficiaries are the business community. We vetted this with them thoroughly, and they felt comfortable with it. It's worth noting that all the refunds we got, even the ones that were pulled back and delayed, we tried to get those out July 1st, July 2nd, since the official year turned over. So we're really looking at a very limited tool in order to fund something that's going to make the system work better for all taxpayers. we think it's a reasonable trade-off.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, my point is, why would we set some new precedent when we have $236 million now sitting unrestricted on the bottom line on June 30th?
And Madam
Chair, I think, Commissioner, if you can get us that answer, that'll help us. Because if you come back and say the governor can do that, I think that's another way. So I think it's worth trying to find an answer to that question. Commissioner?
Oh, Madam Chair, Senator Bach, you're absolutely right. We'll run that option by the governor's office of the governor. That may be another way to get there.
Further questions from any conferees on federal conformity? I do want to add one piece for everyone to just think about, because we're going to go to the break here, and then we're going to start with Green Acres. But I think it's easy to think, well, let's not conform to some of these things because we can raise the revenue later and spend it on something else. And I think that's not actually accurate. It is for big pieces, but that's not what this bill has got going here. So can either the commissioner or the assistant commissioner talk about, you know, could you try to take just the revenue raisers that are actually kind of teeny and go spend them on something else? And as I recall, the original dollar amounts on the extensive spread revenue estimates, which I see Ms. Cadoon has in her hand, were in the hundreds of thousands to not do different things. The delay of the refund is what allows the money that we need immediately, and then these revenue raisers actually raise a lot of money in the many years out. I think it's in mostly 2013 and 2014. So I think some legislators in both the House and Senate, both parties, may think that that's a revenue you can get this year and spend it on something in this biennium, and that's really not what it takes. Many years to collect the money, the revenue out into the future. So, Ms. Cadoon, can you comment on that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, some of the revenue raises, for example, the increased expensing and depreciation provisions. Those would then obviously have some net loss in the early years, but then they have revenue raisers in the early years. So if you don't adopt those, then obviously you don't get those revenue raisers. So you're keeping the depreciation now versus later, the expensing now versus later. There are certain provisions that were just straight revenue raisers, such as some provisions dealing with tax and different entities, which would be strictly revenue raisers. Obviously, you could adopt that provision without adopting anything else. You don't really get at the increased complexity and impacting some of those taxpayer issues that I mentioned, like the charitable deduction and expensing and depreciation problem.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Ms. Cadoon, now that we're this late in the tax filing season, I'm wondering if some of the provisions in here might score differently. Here's my example. The $200 deduction for a teacher for classroom expenses, I think, scores at about $1 million. Teachers bought those supplies last year, not expecting to get a tax deduction for that because it wasn't the law. So now if we adopt that provision, I think when that last time I looked at it, it scored at about $1 million in cost. I'm just wondering if we get this late in the tax filing season, for that $200 deduction, if a teacher's already filed, let's say they're in the middle tax bracket of 7.05, or is that what we are, 7.05? 7% of $200 is $14. I mean, is somebody really going to file an amended return and pay an accountant to do that to get $14? I mean, I just kind of wonder if, I kind of hate to spend $1 million if it turns out few people are actually going to go through the trouble of filing amended return because it won't financially make any sense for them to do it. I just kind of wonder what other provisions in here, but that's one of the ones that actually is more expensive than some of the other ones. If the provisions in here, I mean, are people really going to file amended returns when we're this late, and some of the provisions score differently than they did 2 months ago?
Good.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure if anybody from research is here. I think that you're exactly right. Some of those provisions, such as the teacher, for those individuals who have already filed their return, they may very well decide that's not worth their trouble to be an amended return to get a fairly minimal tax reduction due to that. I don't know. I have to go back and talk to research so I can certainly try to do that during the break as well to see if they would be scoring that one different for the 2000 fiscal year 2009.
I think, Madam Chair, I think that's kind of important. I mean, I don't think we should spend money on the sheet here that's not actually going to get spent. So if there's a way to rescore some of these, on the back of the napkin at least, I think that would be helpful. That we all know what we're facing in this next biennium, and I think to the extent we have very accurate information on what this bill is going to cost, will help everybody over the next 2 months.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe the Commissioner wants to respond. I think that's a legitimate point on some of the obvious ones, like the ones you mentioned. I think the rougher ones and the tougher ones and the ones why we really need to get this done immediately is these multi-year expensing that are really difficult for corporations and small businesses to keep two sets of books. And it's so complex that you can see why you haven't heard this outcry from the business community against the corporate delay in the refund, because you know you're looking at a 39-year problem. So I think you've mentioned one, and I don't think there are very many like that where you could potentially rescore and find a savings there. So, Commissioner, can you think of others in here?
No, Madam Chair, Senator Black, the question's a good one. It's one I've asked myself about, especially the education expenses. Mm-hmm. If you get the sole late in the game, how many people are actually going to make the effort to file and then return for pretty much a nominal tax benefit? But my recollection is, and Dr. Wilson can correct me if I'm wrong, is that even when we passed federal conformity just in conjunction with the Lottery Omnibus Bill, we have not rescored the federal conformity provision based on late passage. I don't think we've done that before. But it raises a question I ask myself. How much T-shirt actually going to find in terms of $15?
Commissioner, are there others like that one that you can think of? I mean, maybe Ms. Manzi or Mr. Michael has a thought. I mean, I'm trying to think of any other provisions in here that fit like that. Ms. Cadoon, did you want to jump in?
Madam Chair, the other one I can think of would be this IRA distribution one that for some taxpayers, if it's a fairly small amount, like the individual who maybe just did an IRA distribution of $300, it might not be worth their time, same like the teachers, to do an amended return. But that I would think would be a fairly small reduction.
Ms. Manzi, can you add anything to this?
Madam Chair, we did make up a list earlier of the provisions that affect tax year 2008 returns, and many of them are business-related provisions, and generally the businesses are either haven't filed their returns yet in anticipation of what the legislature is going to do, so they would be taking them. Or they're ones, like Ms. Cadoon mentioned, the IRA distribution, where I think if the person made a substantial distribution from their IRA that they were able to exclude from adjusted gross income, then it would very much be worth their while to go back and file an amended return and to recalculate all of the AGI-related items for state purposes. Other items for tax year 2008 had to do with farmers and ranchers who donated conservation property being able to take a larger deduction, and that would be even if it exceeded 50% of their adjusted gross income. So again, that would be deductions that would probably be substantial in size and would be worthwhile for people to go back and take with an amended return. There were a great many depreciation and expensing items, which businesses would be tracking and would certainly go back and take the more advantageous basis that conform to federal law. Let's see, there were deductions for business taxpayers of food inventory and book inventory. There was a relaxation of the 10% adjusted gross income limit on casualty loss deductions for residents of Cook, Fillmore, Freeborn, Houston, Maurer, and Nobles counties.
Ms. Manzi, can you repeat that one again? And can we make sure that Senator Box heard that one? Can you repeat that one?
Is this something about the swimming pool?
No, that's a swimming pool, Larry. That's a different one. Okay. Ms. Manzi, can you repeat that one again?
Residents of certain counties in Minnesota, specifically Cook, Fillmore, Freeborn, Houston, Maurer, and Nobles counties, who suffered casualty losses in a disaster that occurred between May 20th and July 31st of 2008 that were not reimbursed, are able to deduct those losses without regard to the 10% adjusted gross income limit. So if someone had unreimbursed casualty losses, they would probably go back and file an amended return to deduct them.
Ms. Manzi, can I just interrupt? I need a little bit more. Is that the Ham Lake Fire?
It's the Ham Lake Fire, Madam Chair, and nobody from Cook County has called or written me and asked for that. I think so they're probably not making any money, so the deduction probably doesn't do them any good.
Chair Bach, can I get your mailing labels?
Madam,
I'd like to let them know.
Madam Chair, Representative...
so they can call you.
Just so I don't forget, Representative Dill really needs that swimming pool levy position. I got another email on today from one of his constituents in Babbitt that was wondering how it was coming. They're all doing private fundraising to save the pool. And it's really important to his... continue your service in the legislature. So it would be nice if you could accommodate him on that. I just wanted to make sure I got
Senator Bach, that on his behalf. Did you see all the House conference pages on the
time? You don't have a bias for even hearing the
question. We don't want to encourage them.
You're going to hear it, though.
Does that my part?
We heard it in K-12 education, finance, which I serve on. And I did have a few questions for Representative Dill.
Why did they get over there?
It's a school levy.
It's a school related issue. So I've seen it quite clearly.
Senator Bond, the tax committee hasn't asked to get it to taxes yet. I'm hoping
did they pass it over there?
Oh, no.
Leave
it there.
Lay it over.
Do they incorporate in their education bill, then?
Possible inclusion.
Does Representative Dill know this?
I hope so.
I don't think he serves on education. It'd be a shame if that didn't happen.
Dill has argued long and hard for the school pool levy. Was that Speaker, former Speaker Anderson, who got that?
I was here when Speaker Anderson did the levy for International Falls, Little Fork. Anybody else? Did Baudette get in that? Two school districts.
It's just one pool, isn't it? They know how many swimming pools it is. Do you know?
It must be one of those four. Must be two pools.
Mr. Michael, how many swimming pools? Two swimming pools. Their own special levy.
But Senator Saxelock thinks it's an important provision.
Okay.
Do we do it for ice rinks anywhere? Yep.
Okay, sorry, Ms. Manzi. Did you want to finish your list?
Madam Chair, there's just a couple more items. There were more generous limits for charitable contributions made for Midwestern disaster relief efforts. And then the final item was a revenue raiser that would be in effect for tax year 2008. So those people affected by that would not have a choice about filing an amended return. They would be required to file the amended return.
Further questions from any conferees on anything related to federal conformity? We think we've got the Senate completely convinced now that all of federal conformity needs to happen in the next day or two here. We want to take a second to have Representative Hosh introduce himself. He's our sixth conferee. Representative Hosh, where do you represent? Because we kind of went around and said that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Larry Hosh. I represent District 14B, which is pretty much the district smack dab in the middle of the state. Green Acres is a large issue for us in Stearns County, and I think my district probably has the most individual parcels enrolled in Stearns County of any district in the state. So I appreciate the opportunity to be part of this committee.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, let's restart.
What happened to the other pinch hitter you've been bringing up? Beatrix, is she still here?
These people yelled about her about Green Acres when she did.
Madam Chair, speaking of Green Acres, didn't you have any bills introduced about Green Acres? I see it's all blank on the House.
We're going to get to that after the break. Senator Skoy, can I just say, take this minute before we recess to say that Senator Bach and Senator Skoy and senators will probably think I'm nuts when I tell them this, but I actually listened to all of the testimony and all the tapes of the Senate dealing with Green Acres and was in fact shocked to see what the Ag Committee did to Senator Skoy's bill. I don't know. It is amazing. But I also listened to Senator Skoy present his bill that is now in this bill and with truly Senator Scoy has been very thoughtful, and we appreciate that the issue is very complex, and people who want it to be simple, it isn't. It's very complex, and there are many moving parts, and there's a lot of people on both parties here who think Green Acres is just a black and white issue, and it isn't. And so I really appreciate the work of the Senate. We do want to get full conformity, and we have different ideas about Green Acres. But unless there are other questions, we're going to recess, and we'll come back at 5. So if folks want to get something to eat, do it now. And Senator Box got a bill, then we'll come back, and we'll take up Green Acres. With that, we're in recess. Thank you. We'll call the conference committee back to order. So I think we got everybody here, and if they're not in the room, they're close. So I think we'll just start and have Commissioner Ines report to us. What do you learn in the break? So, Commissioner Ines.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I conferred with Commissioner Hansen and Jim Schulhoff of the Department of Finance and ran Senator Bob's question by them, essentially. And they are receptive to that. I think that's an acceptable way to go. I think they share some of your same concerns, Senator Bach, about setting a precedent with the corporate refund proposal. So they're receptive to that as long as the revenue cost over the 3 years, 09, 10, 11, is comparable to what the governor recommended in his initial budget. And I think we're very close as far as the House position and the governor's position in that respect. I think we're doing some quick math, and if the House were to drop the 08 conformity for the education expense, I believe it would be, and the numbers would be almost identical to what the governor initially recommended in his budget in January.
Okay.
We're running the numbers, crunch the numbers, and I believe getting head nods from Dr. Wilson and Ms. Cadoon. So that was they're willing to pay for the 09 money that's available, Senator Bach, but they don't want to, declare a bigger budget issue.
So, Madam Chair, Commissioner, if I offered up that the Senate might be willing to do 179, Section 179 conformity and spend an extra $20 million, Governor's not interested in that?
Commissioner.
And we talked about that being an extra $20 million, $22 million.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I didn't think that was before the conference committee, but if it was, the governor would be willing to, if that was going to be added to the federal conformity package, I think the governor would be more than willing to accept that.
So he is willing to go above his number.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, the conference committee doesn't have 179 conformity before it, so that was where that was part of it.
Okay, Assistant Commissioner Cadoon, do you want to add to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I just wanted to make clear, for the Section 179, those provisions were impacting calendar year 2009 and 2010, so it's just for fiscal year 10 and fiscal year 11 was passed, and 12 and 13 as well. So it was not impacting fiscal year 09 for the governor's recommendation.
But I think we should be clear, there is a provision in the bill on Section 179, so it's not as though it's not potentially something the conference committee could discuss.
Yeah.
We wanted to do that or something to maybe stimulate any additional. Would it cause the rescoring of our upfront exemption on capital equipment, Commissioner, do you think? Or is that already upfront exempt?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I think there's two different issues there as far as the 179 expensing and the sales tax exemption for capital equipment. So I don't expect that those two would result.
Just wondering if we adopted the 179, if it might create any additional purchases.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Bach, that was one of the reasons why we put it in the bill. We thought it would provide an additional incentive to boost investment, especially for small businesses who are maybe on the fence about whether to invest in their business. One of the reasons why we put both those provisions in our tax bill was to try to incent some of that investment in small businesses.
But Commissioner, if there was additional purchases made because now the 179 expensing opportunity was there, would that change the scoring of the upfront exemption on capital equipment? Or?
Commissioner, Senator Bach, I think Dr. Wilson might be in better position to comment on that. We had those two pieces in our bill, so there may have been some interaction with Dr. Wilson.
Commissioner, Senator Cohen would be shaking in his boots if he was here right now.
Dr. Wilson.
Maybe someone thought the Senate wanted to do this after all this and the House didn't want to.
Chair Bach, the House has already proposed doing it this year. In fact, it's been in my bill that's already been heard. But this proposal was not offered by the Senate, the House, or the governor in an early conformity bill. It's being offered by the governor in a May conformity bill. And we'll be happy to see if it's in your bill. But we have already heard House Bill 1872, and I have stated it was intended to be part of
the governor's bill.
1782. And I stated that my hope is that will be part of the omnibus tax bill, so we have proposed it.
Do we know if, Council, do we know if anybody's introduced the governor's tax bill?
Why did that too?
Senator Sandrum introduced it now.
And Senator Bach, and I'm the author of the governor's tax bill in the House. So I'm offering mine, his, and everybody else's. So, you got anything you need heard in the House, send it over.
Okay, how many Green Acres bills did you get?
Well, we're going to get to that. So if we can get finished with this, click here the spreadsheet, which we forgot, and then get to Green Acres. I think that's good. But this is good to have this information, Commissioner. We appreciate it, Dr. Wilson.
I'm sure, Mr. Cuddy. When we do estimates for the upfront, for those upfront capital equipment or something of that sort, they're based on the February forecast. They have to be. And we really don't have the kind of interactions you're talking about are type of interactions we just don't have the capability to make anyway. So we would not be adjusting that for that.
Senator Bach?
Thank you.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you so much. Appreciate that you took care of that, Commissioner. Thank you, Dr. Wilson. And if Ms. Templin, Ms. Manzi, and Ms. Von Mosch can join us, we did forget to just quickly do the spreadsheet on federal conformity. And I think this is really helpful for all conferees, particularly Senate conferees, to see when we're talking about the money issue. I think one way to think about how the House paid for it is this is just a timing issue. If we would have had money on the bottom of the line when the House was trying to do this, you know, we could have used it. As Senator Bach is now mentioning, because there is money on the bottom line, but we were trying to do it right after unallotment. There was no money, and so we were trying to move these revenue chunks that are coming in later forward on the calendar. So it's strictly a timing issue, and I think if we quickly walk through the spreadsheet, which should be in everyone's packet, everyone will see how we were trying to just time the money to move the pieces around to make it work. So I don't know, Ms. Templin or Ms. Von Mosch or who wants to...
Madam Chair, Conference Committee members, I'm Cynthia Templin from House Fiscal Staff, and I think the approach we want to take is just to go over the summary sheet, and if there are questions on the detail, we can turn to the other pages. To start, I think we will also review just the fiscal 09 revenue impact and then the 10 and 11 biennial impact and 12 and 13 biennial impact. To begin for the House, the HEROES Earning Assistance Relief Tax Act of 2008. In fiscal 09, there is a revenue gain of $90,000. For the Heartland Habitat Harvest and Horticulture Act of 2008, there is a revenue loss of $370,000, and the Housing Assistance Tax Act of 2008, there is a $15,000 revenue loss. And finally, the fourth act, the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008, there is a $15.5 million cost for a total federal conformity revenue impact of $15.7 million in fiscal 09. Moving down the corporate franchise tax refunds, there is a delay of refunds from fiscal 09 to fiscal 10, and we see that revenue gain in fiscal 09 of $15.7 million. And moving down to the bottom line, the fiscal 09 cost for the House position is revenue neutral.
Yes, Senator Scalia.
Thank you. Just at this time, maybe I could ask, the $15 million that you're delaying, I understand this is kind of a rolling delay, and so how many weeks or days or months does it take to accumulate that $15 million before you start paying something back out again?
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, I believe that the department could answer that in more detail, but I believe what I've heard, those are the $15 million in revenue gain is from the delay of April, May, and June refunds, and that they would delay the May 1st refunds, and then then they would pay them back on a first-in, first-out basis.
So to start with, it would be about 90 days, and then it would gradually shorten up as time went along?
Ms. Templin's probably not wanting to answer for the department, is my guess. Soon, or Commissioner Ines, does somebody want to?
I can wait on this.
Okay. I think they're nodding, though. I mean, I think that's in general. I just
the concept is about right.
Madam Chair, Senator Squire, we would, the estimate was for corporate refunds would be $30 million expected to go out between April, May, and June. What we'd likely do is start holding them May 1st just to make sure that we hold back enough $15 million, and we don't know exactly when those come out, so that's why we start a little earlier in the process. The bill would say we'd release them all by July 1st, so if we had to hold them all, we'd hold them. Release them all on July 1st, but the hope would that we could structure it in such a way that we do it more on a first-in, first-out basis, and so as we accumulated enough $15 million to meet this target, then we'd be able to start releasing some of those that we held come May 1st. We try to do that to minimize any interest payments that have to be done, as well as minimize any delay to the corporate filer.
And
Senator,
so, Ms. Kadoon, Madam Chair, and Ms. Kadoon, so in August, what would you anticipate the delay would be? None.
None. Anybody who was delayed would go out July 1st.
And
it would then be processed as normal after that.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Kadoon, and there is the potential then that you'd have to do something comparable to that again the next year?
Madam Chair, Senator Squire, then our understanding would be to make sure that we hold enough and then following biennium. We would have to then start holding a much smaller amount of $7 million. So we would have to probably hold it for 2 week period, say in June, to make sure we met that target.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator Scoy, I think we're all on freeze. Your question really helps. So you can just jump ahead on the spreadsheet to the next biennium in the delay area, and you see that smaller number is the $7.1 million. So that's what Ms. Kadoon was just stating. Senator Vandiver.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if part of the goal here was to get money out, like the stimulus packages, and we do have the $207 million or whatever it is, wouldn't it make sense at this point to get it out then and not hold the corporate refunds?
Yes, Senator Vandiver, I agree. I think you're right. We were trying to do it when there was no money. Now, as Senator Bach and Commissioner Ines were just talking about, if there could be agreement to use it, it's just a timing issue for all the money. So we probably could do that. But this bill was created when there wasn't anything available. So you can see there's two rounds of delay. There's the $15 million and the $7 million in the next biennium. And both of these numbers come from just trying to back into, you know, there's $30 million of biennium available. The numbers were chosen to back into what you need to buy to get
right.
some money.
I understand that. Flow. It just looks like at least this year we could just take care of it and if we were going to do it.
Yes, Senator Vandiver, I agree. And we would have to do it for, you know, both bienniums. We couldn't just... Right, but not till the third. So I think it helps if Ms.
Madam Chair, if you spend money in nine, it actually raises money in the next biennium and
right.
in the one after. I mean, it's 8.6 to the good. So, I mean,
right.
In 10 and 11.
Yep. And that was really the goal. We were trying to get the revenue down the road that people can see on the spreadsheet. We just didn't have any way to start the motion. So if we could get the O9 money, yes, I think that works. So Ms. Von Losch or Ms. Templin want to just finish this and I think we'll move to Green Acres.
Okay, so Madam Chair, I'm going to go ahead and finish the House spreadsheet side, and then Ms. Von Losch will go to the Senate. So looking at the biennium for fiscal 10 and 11, the revenue impact of all four acts, as Senator Bach noted, is a revenue gain of 8.6 or almost 8.7 million in fiscal 10 and 11. Moving down the spreadsheet, you can see that there is a delay of refunds, the cost. Yeah.
for delaying the refunds in 10 and 11 is $8.7 million. So there is the impact in the 10 and 11 biennium is, again, revenue neutral. I also want to point out that in fiscal 10, that the department scored an additional $50,000 for additional interest on delayed refunds, and you see that show up in fiscal 10 and 11. And then moving to the fiscal 12 and 13 biennium, the revenue impact of the four acts again raises $7.5 million. Most of that additional revenue comes from the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008. And again, moving down the spreadsheet, you can see the revenue impact from the delay of corporate refunds is $7.6 million. For a bottom line gain in fiscal 12 and 13 of a positive $390,000 in fiscal 12 and 13.
Thank you. Ms. Von Lasch.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Looking at the Senate position on the spreadsheet, the Senate conforms to all provisions of the HEROES Act, which is the top line, at a cost of $90,000 in FY09. $140,000 in FY 10 and 11, and $145,000 in FY 12 and 13. And then skipping down to the Housing Assistance Tax Act, and the Senate conformed to two provisions within that act, and both of them were related to bond interest for tax-exempt housing bonds, and the negligible is actually on the wrong line because it's showing up under the Heartland, but it really is under housing assistance. So you can see that the bottom line for our federal conformity piece is the same as the numbers I just read, $90,000, $140,000, and $145,000. In Article 2 of our bill, we have the Green Acres provisions, and we do have a separate revenue estimate for that. And like most of, well, like all of the revenue estimates that we've all been looking at for Green Acres this year, they've all been scored as unknown because the number of acres that would be changing classification is can't be determined right now. So you see our bottom line net general fund impact is $90,000 in FY09, $140,000 in 10 and 11, and $145,000 in 12 and 13.
Thank you both so much. Is there anything else either one of you want to add before we jump to Green Acres, Ms. Templin?
Just really quickly, Madam Chair, that we will be updating this spreadsheet and posting it online.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Ms. Cadoon and Commissioner Ines both, because this is, I think we all have some homework tonight to think through to see what we can get done on the how to pay for federal conformity. So that's helpful. Okay, so thank you. So I thought what would be best, and I talked to Senator Bach about this, I think we want to have someone on Senate staff tell us what the Senate provision is for Green Acres, and we want to have Ms. Baker and Mr. Hines from the House then go through the House's myriad of positions. So there are myriad numbers of authors and hours of testimony. So you get a sense of what the House is thinking.
Has the House passed any provisions so that they have an official position on Green Acres?
We have a couple of times in the body of the whole have a position that repeal has not been successful. There's been a couple of attempts on full repeal and that has not succeeded. Beyond that, no. Nothing. But that doesn't mean that this group doesn't accurately reflect 134 members' views of what we ought to do. And that's why they're all here. Further comment?
Our rule members.
That's right.
But they reflect the views. It's a good thing we have Senator Dubble on here to reflect the views. Somebody
can
reflect the views of the first
class city. Well, and Senator Bach, you'll recall that I have Green Acres in my district. And if you stand in the parking ramp of the Mall of America and throw a rock, you can land it on a Green Acres parcel.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble does have three bills up in transportation. So.
Okay.
And I'm going to have two up later. So.
Thank you. Yeah. Appreciate that. So, Ms. Goff, do you want to help us through what the Senate few is on Green Acres.
Sure, Madam Chair, members. Article 2 of the Senate unofficial endorsement of House File 392 is the Green Acres proposal. Section 1 of the, and this begins on page 9 of your side by side.
Do you have a summary?
Yeah.
There's a summary that on page 9 of that side by side.
On the side. Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Okay.
And if you're looking at the bill, it begins on page 10 of the section.
Thank you.
Version. Section 1 has two provisions in it. This is the section dealing with the basic requirements for qualifying for Green Acres. One is intended to essentially grandfather in parcels that had been subject to Green Acres under the pre-2008 law. But after the enactment of the 2008 law, would no longer qualify for Green Acres because they had less than 10 acres of the traditional farmland, of the Class 2A property. So that would permit that kind of property to remain treated under Green Acres. There's a second provision in Section 1 that strikes the prohibition on including land that's in the RIM or the CREP programs or similar programs for being considered as part of the Green Acres parcel. So after this, those properties would be eligible for Green Acres treatment. Section 2 is a series of amendments to the provision that was adopted last year dealing with the transition of the 2B property that would no longer be eligible for Green Acres treatment. And there's a number of changes here. The first is that we struck the language that had essentially provided that the entire parcel would have been eliminated from Green Acres treatment if only a part of it had been sold, transferred, or divided. So the effect of this change is to say that just the part that is sold or otherwise transferred of that 2B land would be eliminated from the Green Acres treatment. But the 2B land under this proposal would be excluded from Green Acres and no longer subject to Green Acres treatment after the 2013 assessment. So it would be the earlier of a transfer or the 2013 assessment for the 2B land. The language dealing with the 7-year recapture is stricken so that in all circumstances, if there's a recapture, it will come under the existing or the previous law 3-year recapture provision. We also provide specifically that a transfer to a son or daughter of the owner won't disqualify the land from continuing in Green Acres treatment. And then provide too that property that had been assessed under the subdivision that's removed from Green Acres and moved into the new land conservation property tax program that's addressed further in this proposal would not have a recapture. Section 3 modifies the general recapture provision that was in effect before the 2008 law to provide a window so that any property that had been subject to Green Acres that's removed from the program between May 29th of 2008, which was when last year's bill was enacted, and before January 1 of 2010 is not subject to any recapture. Section 4 is the new land conservation property tax program. This program would apply to Class 2B property under two circumstances. Either it was Class 2B property that had been included in Green Acres, had been subject to Green Acres treatment prior to the 2008 law changes, agricultural homestead that's contiguous to 2A land and under the same ownership as the 2A land. So those are the categories of Class 2B property that would be eligible to be treated under this new program. The land has to consist of at least 10 acres, and the owner has to establish a conservation management plan for the land. There's some detail in the bill about the requirement that this plan would be prepared by an approved plan writer. Under the current draft, the Board of Water and Soil Resources would certify people who would be eligible to function as an approved plan writer. The land would have to be enrolled for at least 8 years under this covenant, and there would be at least a three-year period, I believe, during which the first 3 years there could not be an application to remove the land from the program.
Sorry, Scott. Excuse me.
Madam Chair, Ms. Lopp, I think the first eligibility time period is 4 years.
And you do have to give at least 4 years' notice to get out of the program as well. Land wouldn't qualify if there were any delinquent property taxes on it at the time of the application. And it's also not eligible, property's not eligible for enrollment if it is at the same time subject to Green Acres or the Open Space Recreation Law or the Sustainable Forest Law, or as well to being treated or assessed under a conservation easement provision. There's some detail on the application. Maybe that's not important to go through right now, but the owner of the property has to apply by May 1st of the year prior to the tax and payable year and would enter into a covenant that would be binding on the owner and the owner's successor or assigns, and that would run with the land. So even if the land was sold, that covenant would remain in effect until it could be terminated. When the covenant is terminated, and essentially during the time when the land is in this program, it's going to be subject to a reduced valuation so that the value of the property that's subject to the covenant would not exceed the value that's described by the Commissioner of Revenue for Class 2A tillable property in that county. So, you know, any potential development value or value that's attributable to other factors would not be considered. And this would apply to the property, to the land, but would not apply to the house, garage, and surrounding 1 acre.
Madam Chair.
Thanks, Mike.
Sorry to interrupt you, Ms. Hoff, but members, I just wanted you to think about this valuation for a minute, because what the discussion point on these parcels are is that there is outside pressures driving up the value of A-land. And so what our thought was is we would remove those outside pressures off of this land, even though it's not A-land, it would be part of an A homestead or something. Remove the CI, the residential, the seasonal rec, and go to the A-land. And that's the value that Ms. Hoff was talking about. So if there's outside pressures, you remove those, and then the value would be the same as if it didn't exist. So kind of try to get that thinking about in your head of the reason for the value to be where it is in the market and what you want to reduce it to.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, members, similarly to the Green Acres program, special assessments that are levied after June 1st of 2009 would be deferred, as similar to the way in which they are under the Green Acres program. When the covenant has been terminated, the land would be subject to a recapture of the previous 3 years' worth of the difference in the property taxes based on the value under this program versus what it would have been as the ordinary market value. Section 5 is a provision not related directly to the Green Acres Law so much as it is a business classification of agricultural land. Under current law, it's provided that Class 2A property may contain property that would otherwise be classified as 2B, specifically including sloughs, wooded wind shelters, acreage abutting ditches, and similar land if it's impractical for the assessor to value that separately from the rest of the property. The amendment in this section would require the assessor to include this property rather than have that be optional, to include that class 2B type of property in Class 2A. As to the specific types of properties that would be subject to this, ravines and rock piles, And it also adds the qualification that the property would be included if it's unlikely to be able to be sold separately from the rest of the property. That's in addition to it being unlikely to be or impractical for the assessor to value separately. Section 6 requires the Commissioner of Revenue to study and annually report to the chairs of the committees on taxes. Regarding trends in market values of Class 2A and 2B properties, Green Acres value methodology and determination, and assessment and classification practices pertaining to Classes 2A and 2B properties.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hall. And I think maybe what I'd like to do is just kind of turn this over to Reps and Marquardt to kind of, you know, I don't know what all, Ms. Baker and Mr. Hines, but Reps and Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And that's correct. The House does not have an official position. And you fall back on current law, of course. But even though we, I think, there's been 18 bills that have been introduced, I think we heard 17 on March 17th. So we've had plenty of discussion, but before I say any more, if Ms. Baker and Mr. Hines is over, we've got a matrix of all of the various bills, and if you could quickly run through those, that would be great.
Oh, use your microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, also, Representative Junkie heard a couple days worth of hearings at least and produce some bills out of his Ag Committee.
The main trade.
Oh, current. Okay.
And over here. Yeah.
Madam Chair, should I?
Yeah, please. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, no, please, yes. We lovingly call this the Matrix, okay? So that's what y'all want to see here. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm going to start by covering the first page of this handout quickly, just to give a sense of the sort of consensus of the House, perhaps by just the features of the bills that were introduced. And what we tried to do is extract from them the common elements and isolate the differences to the extent we could. And the first five columns or so deal with rural vacant land that's no longer eligible for Green Acres under the 2008 changes. And the first line of the matrix is current law, just to refresh everyone's memory on what is in current law in these various features. And then any place there's a blank in the matrix indicates that bill did not propose to change that aspect of current law. The first column is the feature to allow you to withdraw part of your land without withdrawing all of it, and that was virtually unanimous. All the bills had that provision as did the Senate provision, as Ms. Zopp said, stated. The next feature had to do with whether this rural vacant land could remain in the program if it was transferred. And most of the bills provided for this, sometimes they limited it to some relatives, and there were a little different definitions of the relatives. Some did not restrict it to certain relatives, and they could just transfer it to anyone. So it's more a grandfathering of the land versus the land ownership, I guess is the way we had come to talk about it. The third one, a column that drew a lot of interest, was the deadline to withdraw at the reduced rate. This was the 1 year provision that was put in law at the January 2nd of 2009 date that everybody, I think, is familiar with, that caused so many problems. And basically almost all the bills proposed extending it out 1 year to 2010. And sometimes they specified January 1st and sometimes May 1st, but I think that was more the way Ms. Baker and I ended up drafting them, that it really probably could have been the May 1st with maybe a preferable date on that. The next column has to do with the back tax payment for a property that was withdrawn before that deadline. This was the 3 years under current law, under the law that we passed. This was a 3 year versus seven. And as you can see, some of the proposals did not change that, many of them eliminated that so that there would be no back taxes if you withdrew within the 1 year deadline or the 2 year, depending on how you want to measure it from now. And then finally, then the other one is the back tax if you didn't withdraw at the early deadline. So if you left it in, and that was the provision that was changed to 7 years. Many of the bills shorten that back to the 3 years that had been in existence before. A few did not change it. Representative Detmer's bill actually changed it to 5 years. And then the next set of columns deal with sort of not particularly that related to the grandfathered land. The first one there is there was an explicit prohibition against CREP and RIM lands to be included in Green Acres placed in last year's law, and most of the bills, many of the House bills, did eliminate that prohibition, which would have reauthorized that kind of property to be in Green Acres. Then these next few columns are where there's not as much uniformity. A number of the bills did broaden the definition of Class 2A, and Ms. Zoff described that the Senate bill did some of that as well, getting at the sloughs, wind shelters, carrying that perhaps somewhat further. Some of the bills then in the next column allow some rural vacant land to qualify for Green Acres. Some of the bills did actually explicitly say that some rural vacant land could be in Green Acres in the future. And the next page is where there's sort of the next two pages of this handout kind of get into more detail on some of these features in the last two columns. And then the final column on that first page is a number of the bills did create conservation programs for certain kinds of lands, not some similar to the one in the Senate provision, but all. I should add that the last bill listed on the list before the repeal bill is House File 1663, is really the Senate bill as it was introduced by Representative Jackson. I think Karen's going to need to go through pages 2 and 3.
Okay, excuse me, just a minute. Did you catch that there on the Senate side? So, which is the Jackson bill? 1663 is the same as your bill, Senator Scott. And we intentionally got it and tried to draft it so we could get it in and get it heard so we could get it done here. And so that, so you can see where the Senate bill lines up in the matrix, so it's on there. So think of 1663 as the Senate position. Okay? Is that an accurate portrayal? Okay. Thank you. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I wanted to make that clear. Thank you.
Going on then, if you just look at the second page, like Mr. Hines just stated, the second and third pages are really just backup for some of these items to explain them a little bit more. And very quickly, you can see on the broadening the definition of Class 2A that there were four bills there that actually expanded that definition. And what we did is like the first one for Faust, that's actually current law where we're showing what was actually struck in current law and then what we added here, or what was added. And the Faust bill and the Jackson bill on the 1663, they're quite similar in that both of them are getting at, in the Faust bill, it talks about the interspersed with productive agricultural land such that it would be impractical for the property to be sold separately. And that was some language that came out of the Ag Committee when Representative Junkie, when they were working on the bill. The bottom on allowing some of the rural vacant land to qualify, you can also see that there was a few different ideas here on with the Faust bill that was the only bill that actually went just for the agricultural homestead to be enrolled in Green Acres. And it also was limited to a number of acres equal to 2A. So you couldn't have more 2B land than you had 2A land. But it grandfathered in the current properties from a standpoint of homestead. So it wasn't, or for non-homestead, I'm sorry. So it wasn't like it took any of the ag non-homestead out. And then the Jackson, she had a House File 634 where she actually has prairie, wetland, wasteland, or woodland that's contiguous to real property that's devoted to ag purposes. So she was coming up with a different kind of definition of what should be considered rural vacant land and included in to be able to be included in Green Acres. Then if you turn to the last page, these were the conservation programs that were in some of the bills, and the House File 99, Adkins, that is, I think, the companion for what you put in the Senate language.
That's companion.
Yes, yes. House File 338, Representative Kalin's bill, that was a different program in that one, counties actually designated preservation and legacy areas, and it had language about giving consideration to creation and preservation of water buffers, wildlife corridors. And in this one, like I said, it was a county option, and people had to, that were, if you were in that particular area that the county set, that the county deemed important, then owners actually had to apply for that to participate in the program. And it also included CREP and RIM. That was automatically eligible, and that required a covenant. And in that case, property was assessed at 25% or 0.25, so it got a property tax break with that particular program. House File 634, that was that provision. She had also the Kalin conservation land, but in addition to that, she had, if you remember the Otremba language that was in the House bill last year, for land that was not being farmed but abutting public waters and contiguous to ag land. She also had that particular provision was put in her bill. And then the House File 1663 is the Senate bill.
Senator Marquardt.
Thank you very much. You know, there's been a lot of input on a lot of these bills. Like I said, back in March 17th, a week ago, 8 days ago, we heard 17 bills in a three-hour meeting and heard lots of testimony and so forth. And kind of from all of the input, you know, from what's come out of Representative Johnson's committee and these meetings and looking at all those 17 bills, Representative Junkie and Representative Conan, Representative Aguinius, Representative Hansen, Madam Chair, and myself, we've been kind of working on things, trying to piece some things together that kind of takes all of this together and kind of compiling that. So, Ms. Baker, if you would, Representative Hansen, Representative Junkie introduced the conservation piece just recently. Could you go over the main points of that, if you would, please?
No. It's being passed out.
Could you just hold on just for a second? And Madam Chair, I also have to say you held a meeting last Thursday inviting all legislators, Democrats and Republicans alike, and so this is input from that too, some of these things you'll see.
Maybe when we get through this, you know, maybe if Representative Junkie and others want to chime in on kind of what where the House is going here. Ms. Baker.
The House File 2113, you have the language, but Steve and I put together just kind of the main points that are in 2113, and it is called Preservation of Riparian Buffers. And what this bill does is it gives a property tax benefit to all that property that is within the 50 to 100 feet of the ordinary high water level from on all lakes, streams, rivers, everything. But there are covenants that are attached to it. The definition of riparian buffer is contained in the bill. It's a strip of area, it goes in deep-rooted native prairie vegetation, including trees, adjacent to all public waters, and it extends the minimum of at least 50, but maximum 100 feet. Public waters is a very broad definition for all rivers, lakes, streams, but it does exclude wetlands. what it provides, that land that constitutes this riparian buffer gets a preferential property tax treatment if there's two different options here. One is if an owner agrees to an irrevocable covenant to maintain the buffer and not to develop the or farm the buffer, the land is valued at 25% of the average value per acre of land classified as rural vacant land in the township. What this does not set up a new classification system. What it's really doing is it's telling the assessor that this strip of land, instead of valuing it at whatever the average value per acre of land, the rural vacant land, would be, it's taking 25% of that, and so it's giving really a 75% reduction in this particular, because here it's an irrevocable covenant. So the farmer or the landowner has really agreed that they will not do anything with this land, and they will keep it in its natural state. If the owner agrees to a revocable covenant to maintain the buffer and not to farm the land for at least 20 years, and that's what the length of the covenant minimum has to be, then there's a reduction in value, so that it'll be valued at 75% of the average value. And of course, in both of these, you're really starting out at the ag value. So, you know, what this does is, in both of these, it gives the benefit of what the highest and best use would have been. So it's really the 25 or the 75 are measured against that. The landowner has to agree to maintain the buffer, and there's language about maintaining it. And the landowner has to file an affidavit every 3 years with the assessor just stating that the buffer is being maintained, and if they don't abide by it, there's language in that they do get like a notice saying, you know, you're not maintaining it. And I think it would be DNR and some of those officials that would see that kind of thing, because I'm not sure that the assessor would be the one that would. But that way, if they're not maintaining the buffer properly, then the tax benefits that were accruing since the property was enrolled would be due and payable, and it'd be pulled out of the program. So,
well, there's kind of two levels of commitment here.
Let me just get a little clear on what's going on. So this would apply to every acre of land next to any creek, lake, or river within the state?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, Senator Scully, it would, if in fact the people or the landowners decided that they wanted to put a covenant on it, and a covenant, and a 50 to 100 foot, I mean, so it's well, 50 foot minimum, 100 foot maximum, but the taxpayer does have to agree to a covenant for at least 20 years or an irrevocable covenant permanently. So this is a conservation program that is protecting the waters.
But Madam Chair, if we were to take a 50-foot buffer along all the lakes and plant this grass, and then they just build their house right off the edge of that, I mean, this is the most valuable land in the state, and we're going to give this land that abuts all our lakes and creeks and rivers and streams this tax break for doing what they legally probably can't do anyway, because it's already classified as some kind of wetland.
I think that if you read how you got it, what you got to do to do it, it's pretty stringent. I mean, I would guess lots of people aren't going to want to do this. This is voluntary. Ms. Baker, Thomas and Senator Scully.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Scully. This can't be residential land. I mean, this has to be rural vacant land that you are doing this to. So I'm not sure that, you know, when you're talking about if you're putting a house on the other side of it, we are not talking
blue
rural
waters.
Vacant land. No, this is not a Blue Waters bill. Not at all.
What Blue Waters is and people around the chat. That's not this, and I think... Yeah. I have to give you some assurance because I hear what you're saying, but that's not
intended. Madam Chair, is the covenant just on the 50 or the 100 feet, or is it on a parcel?
Ms. Baker or Rep. Junkie?
Well, Madam Chair,
and Representative Scoy. Again, maybe we can back up just a brief bit on the conservation piece. Frankly, when we heard bills in our committee, we made the decision in agriculture, if this is an agriculture program, that conservation would be a separate bill. You know, whether it's Metzen or and Atkins or whether it was a Kalin and whoever had that in the Senate, Olsen or whoever, we said, you know, if you want a conservation program, that's great. Go down to the Environmental Committee and set it up and go down to taxes and set it up and we'll talk about it. Now, I know you put it in there probably to garner some votes, maybe. I'm not going to, you know, speculate why it's in there. So one decision I think that we have to make is, do we include a conservation program? And if that's a good thing and we're going to include it, then we ask folks in the House to say, well, what, in addition to what you had suggested, what would also you want included? And so, frankly, Representative Wagenius and Hansen mainly sat down and looked and said, one of our, and Hansen's been on the ditch buffer people, and this isn't on county ditches, it's on rivers and lakes and things, but it's a similar concept, obviously. And so we got to protect our wetlands from runoff in an ag area. So clearly that's a public benefit that they're looking to put in here. And then in deference to, as you know, Representative Scoy and other folks from rural areas, there's always this debate on whether easements should be permanent or temporary. And so we gave two options to a person in here that can put it in more of a permanent easement forever and get a better tax break for it, or, you know, someday we might want to use that land or farm that land or, you know, whatever the needs might be in the future we can't see, and that's why you see the temporary easement, albeit 20 years, but that's temporary in farm speak when you talk about CREP or some of the easements we've done in the past. And so that's why this report. So I think, you know, really what this is saying is, if we're going to put a conservation piece in, let's consider this as a position, either in addition to or with this, yours and something else, but let's add to it and not subtract from it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Junkie, the conservation part of this bill is added in there because there was a significant number of acres that were enrolled in Green Acres that just wasn't ag land. If you read the legislative auditor's report, I think it was 40% or 38% or some huge number like that.
Mm-hmm.
So as we looked at the Green Acres bill and we listened to all the issues that residents across the state and other legislators were bringing forward, we were looking at the traditional ag land. Well, that got covered pretty well in the Green Acres law. Now there was all these parcels that would be non-conforming to the Green Acres, and what happened last year is they got grandfathered in. Well, grandfathers don't work very well for tax policy people because you end up with two parcels getting different treatment depending upon the date that they enrolled in the program. So we tried to get away from the grandfather. That's what brought us to the conservation program. So when you take the acres that are across the state that were enrolled in Green Acres, 60% of them were ag land, so they just go into Green Acres, no problem. Then there's the 40% that's kind of left. What are we going to do with those? Well, I mean, we could have called this conservation program, you know, rural vacant land or who knows what. I looked at what Senator Metzen was working and tracked along closely with him because our two bills moved together in the Senate for the Tax Committee. And then we thought, well, we will get rid of the grandfather, have a place to put these parcels of land that people across the state are saying add value to their communities and give them some preferential tax treatment based on the policies of Green Acres, which was that there are pressures outside of agriculture driving up the land values. So that's where the conservation land comes from. It is an effort to deal with the values on these farms that are adding to their communities. We're going to give them some preferential tax treatment. This is a pretty major expansion of what the Green Acres law was. I mean, this is quite a bit step beyond that. Whereas the parcels that are in our bill are all ag homestead or else have been in the Green Acres program earlier, not bringing land abutting, you know, all the rivers and creeks. And if you have a look at a map of Minnesota, if you include all these parcels of land, it's a lot. I mean, it is a lot. And a lot of that is going to be seasonal rec. It's going to be land that you kind of wonder if you should be giving it preferential tax treatment or not.
So I think that would be a different classification, though. We're not...
Well,
classified seasonal rec.
Yes,
you got to be in rural vacant.
It's only the rural land.
The representative Junkie, you want to further on that?
Well, no, and fundamentally, I agree with what Senator Skoy is saying. I mean, this is still on the rural vacant and green acres parts. It's not on everything. And number two, you know, we... Frankly, what we did in our committees, we listened to all these bills, then we did the delete everything amendment and sent the House bill out, that one of these House bills, the second one, I believe, and that was kind of our position as we came out of Ag Committee. And the way we handled it, your question, your problem, and the way we handled it was you could enroll up to 50% of the tillable, which would be the non, you know, so if you had a 10-acre wooded parcel on a lake, and you had 50 acres of ag land, you could enroll it and be part of that farm unit. So we handled it a different way, but fundamentally, it's exactly what you just described, is to allow those lands to be in. So we're not differing on that. But this is just still on the ag land, green acres ag land, you know, the rural vacant and the ag classifications only. Okay. It's not on everything.
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative Duffy, so how would this interact with the proposed conservation program in our bill?
I'd have to look at that. Of course. I mean, I'm just looking at your conservation plan for the
Senator Skoy, I know Senator Vandiver has something to say. I think House conferees are, you know, we're divided on things like you all are too. But I think we were thinking that, you know, most of these bills had either bring CRP and ring back or don't. Mm-hmm. I think we thought one should come back in the Green Acres,
right,
and one should not.
That's true.
And, you know, there are conferees that can tell you the nuance of how they thought that, and that was with a lot of work from folks who track the conservation issues, too, so I don't know if Representative Junkie can recall.
Well, sure.
CRP
we would include in the House thinking, because clearly that was ag land that was set. There's no question. RIM was a choice you made, and you're already getting enhanced benefits for going into RIM. So you shouldn't need a second enhancement to go into it. You've made that decision on RIM. RIM is typically a 100-year easement plus. And so you've already made that, and you're already getting preferential treatment for that RIM land, where CRP, you know, really is ag land and probably could come out someday and, you know, whatever. So we did make a distinction because of the benefits already allowed under RIM and those types of programs. And so we thought CRP certainly made sense, or CREP, or any of those programs that were in. But that was...
Representative Junkie, to the RIM point, then, does the RIM land have the same conditions for enrollment that it had to have some productive agriculture on it? 4 out of 6 years or whatever.
And Madam Chair, no, not in total. And in fact, but again, RIM is almost is the same as Green Acres, but it's a longer program. And, you know, you can't do anything with RIM land other than shoot pheasants off it or whatever. I mean, that's, you're not allowed to develop. You're not allowed it for a much longer period of time. So someone's already decided to go in there. We don't have to give them another benefit. They're already getting that benefit with the RIM, and they've made that decision.
Senator Vandiver.
Madam Chair, my comments related to the Representative Junkie's environmental component, it sounds like that's off to the side, so at this juncture, I'd...
Thank you. Representative Demmer, thoughts? Brett, what are you thinking with all this? Jump in here. Come on.
Use your mic.
Yeah, use the mic. And because we really, you know, we want to get this done. I think it's great to be able to get resolution here tomorrow. So we got to get everyone on the record what they're really thinking here in a public way. So, Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I tell you, as far as I'm concerned, in the ag land, we're not a long ways apart. If you look at what the Senate has done, you look at the bills that have been introduced in the House, I think we're of the same mind. I think we may need to clean up a couple little things or whatever. But the big thing is the conservation one. And I guess my thoughts... We have not had, I know in Representative Junkie's committee, they've had some discussion about this. This bill, 2113, I think it is brand new, Madam Chair, in members. And I guess, be honest about it, in my opinion, the conservation part probably should be there. There's members and people calling for that. But we have not talked about this much in the House. And I would like to see that brought before committees. And quite frankly, Madam Chair, it should go to your committee, or at least Representative Marquardt's committee, because it's a tax issue. And for us to look at doing this as a conference committee, enacting that without having any hearings or anything in the House, I think, while I'm probably supportive of the concept, I'm not sure the process is quite right.
Madam Chair, I'm just curious. I don't remember how the House operates, but...
Well, you were House trained.
In the Senate, the tax committee is usually the last stop for a bill. Where it goes to the floor. Bills go through and then they stop. The final stop is either finance or taxes and they go to the floor. I'm just curious if the House is different. I noticed this bill got introduced and it clearly should, I would think, have been seen by a number of committees, but for some reason it was referred directly to taxes. And what the thought process is there.
Well, and Senator Bach, I think it got referred directly to taxes because you guys decided to not do all of conformity and put Green Acres in this bill, so we're trying to get ready to kind of get the House's view here. I mean, had we not had a conference committee on federal conformity, we'd be looking to insert our ultimate solution from the Ag Committee, the Environment Committee, and the Tax Committee into Representative Marquardt's division report that would become part of the omnibus tax bill. So we're trying to figure this out on the fly here, and I want to, you know, I agree with Representative Demmer that not everything's perfectly fleshed out. On the other hand, we're constantly hearing the, you know, everybody's ready to till, everyone's cutting down trees, we got to hurry, so we're trying to resolve as much as we can on this conference committee.
I think what Senator Scoy was trying to accomplish, he was trying to find a home outside of the idea of grandfather, where those acreage that was enrolled in Green Acres, that really, I think most of us agreed, didn't belong there. The legislative auditor agreed they didn't belong there. So we were just trying to find another place outside of the grandfather to put them. This bill, 2113, is much more than I think the narrow approach the Senate was trying to take, just relative to those Green Acre, those parcels that had previously qualified for Green.
I think that may be, we hope you'll be open to it, though, because if we can't get this all resolved in this conference committee, we're just going to deal with it all again. So, I mean, we're trying to get everything in front of it, you know, folks who are all here. Senator Olstein, you got a thought?
I have spoken to so many groups and angry groups on the Green Acres issue that I think a lot of the things, you know, the big five were, you know, the three-year payback, pass it on to your heirs, crept, rim, you know, those kinds of lands be included. And then Senator Scoy early on had talked about, you know, a period where if you took your non-productive Green Acres land out, there'd be no payback. And then, so those, a lot of the, all the things that were, I was hearing in different groups that I was talking to about this bill and the thousands, it seems like, emails that I got, I think everything is addressed, and probably from this bar over on your stuff. But when Senator Scoy came up with this conservation covenant, you know, I was surprised by that, but the more I hear about it and I've talked to people, that it sounds like a really nice solution to what do we do with lands that aren't really farmland, but we want to do something to preserve them. And so this seems to me to work out, it gives an option for people to enter into that program, and we can preserve those lands for many years to come. So I'm pretty pleased where the bill is right now.
Thank you. Let's come clean. What are you thinking? Getting everybody's thoughts on here on the record so we can all,
Madam
all
Speaker,
have to think it through.
Or Madam Chair, excuse me. I think, too, on the ag land stuff, we can get there without too much problem, get an agreement here. On this conservation stuff, I think in the House we would have liked to spend more time on it, but you're attaching Green Acres to the conformity bill, kind of run the clock out on us, so we had to move faster than we otherwise would have on that. But with the testimony we heard, there was no question that many of them felt that that these lands that weren't necessarily tillable were so important to the farm for diversity and water quality and all that thing, all those types of things. And I think this bill, 2113, took that pretty serious and said, if in fact that's that important, we need to do something, you know, that's pretty pretty substantial. And I think that bill does that. But and I understand that it goes further than what you guys were looking at in the Senate. To be honest with you, I haven't spent a lot of time with this bill myself, except to understand the basics of why they think it's important for water quality and those types of things. But as we go through this, I would hope that you on the Senate side would look at this and give it some consideration.
As I start calling people out here, I hope people will feel free to just comment about anything, not just conservation, anything on the matrix. I don't know what people are thinking here. Senator Scoy, then Vandiver, and then I'm going to ask Representative Posh to comment. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know who to address the question to, but
let's just
use a real-world solution. I'll use our farm. On our farm, we've got the Clearwater River and the Rocky Brook that flow through it. We've probably got pushing mile and a half or more of riverfront. And most of it would meet this definition. And so I can take that land and I can go down to the county assessor and sign up all those acres and pay 25% of what I'm currently paying on those parcels now?
Forever.
And this land is grass strips. Legally, according to the state wetland law, you can't do anything with it anyway. So I could get a 25, well, I could sign the 20-year.
Then you get
75%.
So we're just putting it
Does that make sense, that you would give me that kind of tax break?
I guess, I think what we were thinking as we were going through this with, the conservation folks in the house, if people are going to get a tax benefit for conservation, we want to make sure they're actually doing conservation. And covenants and whether they're revocable or irrevocable make people actually do it. And so I don't know that people would be willing to do it. And if they're not willing to do it, then they're not going to get a tax benefit. So I think we were thinking more along that line. To that point, before Senator Vandiver, that's a mark.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. There's more to that than just setting it aside. It's that in order to qualify, you also must maintain the buffer. I mean, there's a little bit more than that. I mean, there's a number of things here that you'd have to go one step. So that's just setting it aside. It's inspecting it periodically, preventing vesting any soil compaction from vehicles, control weeds and manage.
Madam Chair, if you guys think about what that land is like, it's grassland. It's been grassland for probably 200 years. I don't know, whatever it is. It's just outside of our field. We left it there to protect the Rocky Brook that flows through our farm. We're never going to do anything with it. We legally can't. But now we're paying, we're paying egg taxes on it because it's part of our farm. Now the river, the wooded river land, I read this, you got to have trees and all that. Well, what are you going to do? You're going to walk out there and say, yeah, the trees are still there? I mean, it's pretty odd that we would give preferential tax treatment to the landowner for doing something that by law they're restricted from developing anyway. It seems a little odd to me.
And, the testimony we've heard on the floor and in the committees is folks that reacted to the 2008 changes want to have all this land that it's conservation. They acknowledge they're not doing agricultural production on. They want to keep a tax benefit, and we're trying to get a read on where the whole house can be in the end on the Senator Vandiver.
Well, Madam Chair, for back on 2113, I don't think I can't see how it fits with what Senator Scoy's bill is trying to do as far as this just deals with the riparian buffer. I don't see how it meshes with the rest of the bill. First of all, and secondly, I think you would be talking about a lot of money here deferred, and then we'd have to talk about process for getting that money back if you're determining. And you can't just have a DNR guy go out and say you're in default and you owe $4,000 or 20,000 or whatever. So I think we'd have to want to see more in that respect. But I don't see how it physically ties in with the non-productive when it's just dealing, looks like, unless I'm reading it incorrectly, it's just dealing with riparian.
Well, I think, Senator Vandeby, I think we were talking about the non-productive lands. Right? And that's what this is all about, is the folks who've had non-productive lands in Green Acres who got taken out, and now they want back in. So I think the House is trying to say if they're going to get some ability to put their land back in, we want to have them show they're actually going to do conservation.
Senator Spiller, what are we at? 35 counties that were never enrolled in Green Acres?
33.
And now we're going to give them all an opportunity, those 35 counties that were never enrolled in Green Acres to start with. Landowners are going to get some opportunity to enroll their land in this program. And what we were trying to address was the grandfathered land in Green Acres, and now this bill proposes to open it up to the 35 counties that were never even participating in Green Acres, because it applies to all agricultural land. I mean, this is, I mean, I don't know how many days you want to spend on this, but it's just a real stretch to think that we're now going to include the 35 acres that were never even, all the ag land that was never even intentionally by the counties, not, the program was never in those counties.
Madam Chair, much of the discussion is dealing around rural vacant land, of course, and we also worked on some things with kind of the traditional Green Acres, and I asked Ken Baker and Steve Hines to put together a bullet point of taking all of the bills together. It might help bring some of this together on how we deal with grandfathering and rural vacant land and so forth. So it's not the conservation part, but it is the group that's been working and looking at all the bills on kind of what we consider the normal Green Acres program. So if they could
I think that's helpful. Representative Dimmer has a question, though, and I wanted to get Representative Hosh's thought there. Get every conferita weigh in on something before we do a next step. Representative Dimmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, my question is for Senator Scoy. I assume this is your language. Is it your intent that the rural vacant land in the new law, let's say current law, rural vacant land in the current law would be allowed with the changes that we had in the, let's just take the part that's not the conservation part, the 7-year eliminated and related parties and all that. Is it your intent that the rural vacant land that's been grandfathered in be there but have a place to go after it's grandfathered? In other words, somebody, if I've got rural vacant land that's grandfathered in, we clean up this other language, and then your intent is to give me someplace to go with that sometime between now and 2013. And at 2013, I have to decide. Is that your intent? And if I can add to that, if I don't have land in, again, with reference, if I have rural vacant land that's not in Green Acres, in your conservation plan, I would have a place to go with that now, too. Is that correct?
Thanks, Clay.
Am I right in terms
of
spirit?
As long as a homestead.
Okay, Representative Jonte and Representative.
I just want to tell everyone, let's not get hung up on the conservation piece, because I think we all are. We're just trying to figure out what to do with those 10 or 5 or 7 acre pieces that were adjoining this land that really could be separated, probably for, because they're on a lake or whatever. And I have a number of those in my district. To the 50 or 100, just the one of the biggest problems we have with all of this, and I think we'll all admit it, and frankly, I don't know if Vanosik is here, but they'll admit it too. A lot of this is the assessor's problem. I do real estate appraisal, I do farm appraisal, I do it all over the state, and when I go into every county, it's different. And some assessors will assess wet, waste, and road. What you're just talking about as not able to farm, it's worth $50 or $100 an acre, and that's it on their assessment. Others will, like you say, put it all into some tillable class, type 1, 2, 3. I mean, it's nuts. And so a lot of this problem is because of assessors, and if we can give some direction to them to get more uniform on what they're doing, Representative Scoy, and I know you've got that in yours, that will help. Otherwise, your language versus what we're thinking, I think, is close. You know, if we if we can come to agreement on the RIM CRP part, if we can come to agreement on the years to be in that conservation. Some people think 8 is too little. Maybe you think 20 is too much. But I think we can, if you're serious about conserving this, you know, I think we're close on a lot of this, and we can kind of blend them. And let's just not get hung up on this, because what we're trying to do is keep that entire parcel, rural vacant and agriculture, as one unit, homesteaded, contiguous land, and I think we're very close. So I don't want us to get hung up on arguing this conservation too much, because I think the ultimate goal is the same, and I think at the end we're going to get what we all were thinking about anyway.
I think that's really helpful, because I think that's a piece, and we've got a bigger chunk to deal with, and we want to just show, we want to show the Senate another idea the House is working on here and get reaction. But first, yes, please, Senator Stark, please.
Representative Junkie, Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, I think if you look at this thing,
matrix,
and matrix down to the one that is my bill, you'll see that the vast majority of the responses above that line are comparable to the responses above that line. With regard to the assessor question, I think you're absolutely right. That's why we took some of the discretion away from the assessors in this current program, and that's why we asked the department to do their review and their report back.
Mr. Hush.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the proposal in front of us, I think 2113, I think it's a good intention and a good direction to go. I can just show you about 20 pictures that a constituent emailed me literally an hour ago, that this would probably be very helpful for their neighbors. However, I mean, I feel that it might be a little premature on where we're going with this. I'd like to know what some of the consequences are to the counties and other local government jurisdictions that I don't think I feel that I've been informed enough on that. But on the general direction of a conservation type of program that we're going, whether it was the House bills that were considered or what's currently in what's in front of us in conferences, I think we've had enough hearings where there needs to be a conservation component. To what extent, I think will be developed here in the next hours. But 2113 is good, but I definitely like to see some testimony or some input from those who are going to be affected by it.
Okay, thank you. So I think this would be helpful, if there's no questions right now, to look at this thing called the Arnold Zippel Bill, Green Acres. So this is a work in progress. Maybe Rep. Junkie Coonan or Marquardt want to talk to what's going on here. Does anybody, Junkie, Marquardt, Coonan, somebody want to jump in on this before staff?
What do you want? Yeah. I was just reading through it.
I was just saying maybe somebody, like Mark or Coonan, want to talk about the process that we even started getting to this point.
Yeah, why won't then, Madam Chair, is just what we tried to do, especially once the Senate hijacked the federal conformity bill of Green Acres. We needed to bring all of the bills and all of the ideas and all of the input that we had heard together. So, you know, we worked on a lot that had come out of Representative Junkie's committee and bills like Representative Hosh and the work that Representative Conan and Demmer did last year and so forth, and after our hearing of March 17th and so forth. So the members I had mentioned earlier, the six legislators, were working on, you know, how can we kind of bring all this together and get to some of these issues in with grandfather, the payback period, the transfer, the rural vacant land, all of that. So that's kind of the process, and we wanted to have some sort of, I guess maybe a position, if you would call that, ready for this, and then also ready for the property tax division report that needs to come out on Monday.
Okay, so Mr. Hines, you want to just quick, you know, and we don't have a bill for this, Senators. We were trying to react to kind of you guys moving quicker, and even though we were hearing those for hours and hours and hours, and we've struggled in the House because we've heard from last year there wasn't enough hearings and enough time and enough transparency, and all of us that were a part of it know that that's not actually accurate, but that perception exists. We've got a timeline what we can pass around to remind everybody about the big, long, drawn-out, open process that was over more than 1 year. But, you know, and
we've been trying to have all this openness and transparency and lots of hearings, and I've listened to hours and hours of tape and Junkies Committee and Eakins Committee, you guys, you know, and we had a bunch in our property taxes and taxes, and so once you guys acted, then we felt we'd at least try to get our heads around where we might be going. So we don't have a bill, and we're not sure on any of these things, but I think if Mr. Hines can just help us start to just walk through some of these ideas, and I think you'll see we're probably closer than maybe the room realizes. Mr. Hines?
Yes, Madam Chair. Just quickly going through these points, and some of them may reflect staff understanding that isn't necessarily exactly the same as the members who were there. We feel that's the case in many places. There might be one or two, so feel free to tell us if you think we're wrong about this. But the first point is that the House Bill 2113 that you've been talking about. The second one, rural vacant land can be withdrawn prior to 5/1/2010 with no back taxes, same as Senate. Number three, revert to three-year back taxes on grandfathered rural vacant land, also the same. Number four, broaden the definition of non-productive land to include in Class 2A. So this is, again, similar to the Senate language about ravines and rock piles, be impractical to sell separately or value separately. Number five, this is a slight difference from the Senate. It allows CRP and non-permanent rim to qualify in the future, and Representative Junkie gave the rationale for why we're making a distinction between permanent and non-permanent rim land. Number six, allows some rural vacant land to be withdrawn without all of it. Number seven, this is a point that there's a memo from DOR about these, what we're calling sort of technical transfers, transfers to surviving spouse, et cetera. Make sure that that language is in, that that doesn't trigger the forced withdrawal. Number eight, this may be the one where we're a little misunderstanding about exactly what we're saying, but grandfathered rural vacant land could be transferred by the owner at the current time to anybody. And still re-enroll in the program, so it could stay in. And then secondly, any time grandfathered rural vacant land is transferred through a will or through a trust, it's allowed to remain in the to re-enroll in the program. So it could always be forever transferred through that mechanism, but current owners could transfer it once just as a straight transfer or sale.
Mm-hmm.
Number nine, no back taxes if you donate land to a government agency or conservation organization when you withdraw. That issue had come up a couple of places of people who donated land and still got hit with back taxes. Number 10, across compliance, and this was say this is a kind of another part of the environmental piece that if a person enrolled in Green Acres was not compliant with all restrictions on what the pesticide and other water types of violations, that they would be removed from the program. Number 11, this is a change future enrollments at Green Acres. So if you come in now from this point forward, putting in a stronger piece commitment, a 12-year back tax instead of three. And then finally, in number 12, is again one that there might be some concern about, but this would be a riparian buffer that we've talked about in 2113, is adjacent to ag land, it gets to be in part 2A. So this would be not with the covenant requirement, but sort of that same kind of land without the covenant requirement, that you'd get to pull that into Green Acres if you didn't want to make the covenant commitment. And that maybe is the one we've discussed least in the group. So.
Okay, and one more piece. If we can get, do we have the documents showing the tax shifting that's going on in current law due to Green Acres? If we can get that passed out so everyone can see it tonight before we finish up, because I think we're making progress in understanding each other and we're not that far apart. The reason, I just want House Conferees, that Senator Scoy said under his breath to me, don't you people learn about the 7-year in reaction to the 12-year going forward? Okay, so we just want to, if the House wants to explain why they would even consider that. Okay, so this is not about anyone who's in Green Acres now. It's not about people who have conservation lands in Green Acres. It's going forward, you know, for the future. And we want all the Senate conferees to take a look at this document. This is a really important document because you know, this is where the ag folks and the conservation folks and the tax folks all start arguing. And that's why if you look at our conferees, we're a combo of those. And so, Senator Boyce kind of bought, what we want you guys to see where we're coming from here. You know, our conferees are a blend of ag interests and conservation tax interests. But for all the folks who weren't a part of this last year, what was the tax committee thinking? What were the tax conferees thinking? Well, this document reminds everybody what the tax conferees were thinking. I mean, what the tax conferees were thinking is that this program is paid for by other taxpayers. And so, if we want to preserve this program and go back to everybody who felt like they had a change who wasn't enrolled and address that one way, but if we want to go forward and say, okay, so if we solve the problem for who is currently enrolled, what are we going to do for the future? We cannot forget there's major tax shifting going on and all other property taxpayers are paying for it. I mean, that's the thing that the conferees, both bodies, cannot leave sight of here. And I think just having grandfathers and these kind of ideas are a significant, erosion of what folks did last year in the tax conference committee. Because people felt like they didn't have time, they didn't understand the rules changed, and I think we all learned through that process. But now going forward, if we take care of everybody who's in it now and say, what about the future? We all need to look at this chart. I mean, there are huge tax consequences for these programs. And so how much do we want to grow? We are shifting $55 million of property taxes from some people to others.
Madam Chair?
And that's going to keep growing. So I just want, as we go forward, everyone has to think about what is the tax policy, and I'll get you in just a second, Senator Olsen. And that is to say, it would be so much easier if we just had a big pile of money and the state just paid for this program. If the state paid for Green Acres and all the other property taxpayers in the jurisdiction didn't have to pay for their taxes, it'd be no problem. We had a big surplus, we could pay for it, and all these other taxpayers wouldn't pay for it. But the law, in fact, is that the state is not paying for this. Everybody who's got Green Acres, their neighbors are paying for it. And what makes it even to me a little more difficult from a tax perspective is the neighbors don't know it. And so first of all, they're paying for it. Second of all, they don't know they're paying for it. And third, they have no one, if they ever figure it out, to hold accountable for it. Because what are they going to do? So if their locally elected officials are in office, their locally elected officials didn't do this. Their city council members aren't taking votes to make this law or change these rules. Neither are their county commissioners. So once they figure it out that they're actually being asked to pay their neighbors' taxes, they can't go vote their locally elected officials out of office. So they can come to the legislature, and what do we do? Well, you know, that's all going on, you know, locally, and we're not paying for that. And so it becomes kind of between the farmers and the assessors, and all the other property taxpayers are paying for the shift. And so we just have to be honest about that. Doesn't mean we shouldn't keep Green Acres or find an alternate solution, but I think when we get to going forward, it is a really legitimate tax issue for the Minnesota legislature for all time. And that's kind of the core. We've got all these people disaffected now and it mad at us. I get that because I can get in all the calls too. And I think we're going to find a good solution for all them. But what about forever? What about for the future? Are we going to shift $100 million of property taxes on other people? $200, $300, $400? I mean, we're ever going to try to limit it? And trying to say, let's put boundaries around future that might be a little more restrictive gives us time to have the tax debate. And we may decide, nope, let's just stick with the way it was because we just can't take it politically. But I think this chart highlights what the problem really is at its core for future years. Senator Spice.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and you're absolutely right. This is why we were working on Green Acres, because of the tax shift. The one thing I would say about when we look forward is if we do have different rules for the people who have the 35 or 33 counties or whatever it is that enroll after today, and then we do for those that enroll, we are treating Minnesotans different. And that's one of the things that the Senate proposal does, is everybody gets treated the same no matter when they enrolled in the program. And you know, I think there's some value in that.
Senator Spire, but with the grandfather.
The grandfather goes away in 2000.
So you have it for 4 years.
Yeah,
so it
goes
away. Okay, so post-conference, can you react to all that, Representative Junkie?
Well, no, you're right. And first of all, just to the 33 counties that don't have it, some counties will never have it. They have no idea what we're talking about. Because all their tillable land is worth more than any of their other acreage.
Right.
If you don't have, and a lot of them don't have lakes, and they don't have a lot of rivers when you get to southwest Minnesota, that's why you don't have any. It's not because they haven't been allowed in or for some reason they're going to come in later, because they're not. They'll never have it. There are a couple of counties, Todd County in particular, that I have to mention on behalf of Representative Trimba, and I don't know what we do with that, but I'm asking Conferees and tax people here. Yeah. Their assessor has made the decision we're not going to do it. I don't think by law, I think the Attorney General, in my opinion, who upholds state law, would have an action against that county for not allowing it in. But that's a question that's on the table that we have to resolve here, too, or get an answer to Representative Trimba if we can. But, you know, on the rest of it, again, Representative Scoy and Olstein and others, I think when you look at the Arnold Ziffel bill, I think a couple things that I think we can come to agreement on, too. You had a transfer on number 8 to relatives only. And again, we differed on that somewhat. I mean, why shouldn't Denver be able to sell his farm to me if I want to continue farming it, or you sell it to Bach? But only once. You get one transfer. And that should be written in there, so you make sure you got your notes right. You're allowed one transfer to anyone. Unless it's by will, when you're not exchanging money, you can then you can transfer the green eight. That's what this was. But
one at a time, or?
But one. Yeah, if you want to comment to that.
Yeah, sure. Sounds fine.
Well, the reason that I didn't do that is because it's an expansion of the program. From what they currently, when they signed up for Green Acres 30, 40, 20 years ago, there were four reasons that they wouldn't have to have a requalification if they did a transfer. It was for death, divorce, marriage, or transfer to a child. And so what we did is we went back to what was being used when they signed on the dotted line 20, 30,
right.
40 years ago.
Right.
And otherwise, it's an expansion.
Right. And Madam Chair, what I'm saying now is going forward. I mean, we have heard through testimony, and it happens in my area too, where the neighbor kid wants to take over the milking operation from the retiring farmer who doesn't have anyone there, and they want to re-enroll this, but he's not a relative. So why not allow one transfer if he agrees to the same conditions, so there's no, you know, no differences in the dollar values involved or the program acres involved. And then that person who gets a transfer will have to make that decision, like you said, then from then on. They'll have to decide if they want to stay in the program under the new rules, or they're out, because they can't transfer yet. It's one transfer only. So to allow some of those relationships that are out there.
Okay, and sorry to interrupt, Representative Junkie. To that point, both Representative Hosh and Demmer want to speak to that point. Representative Hosh?
Well, on the transfer, I think we need to expand it from just son or daughter. I mean, the relationships out there are too many, especially in today's agriculture communities and the economies that we have. I have a lot of individuals who want to pass it on to their grandchildren because their children have decided not to farm, but others within the family want to. And I think Green Acres is an agriculture preservation program, and if we want to preserve agriculture, it shouldn't matter who's doing the farming work, just as long as that continued use moves forward. So I think if they are able to abide by the regulations in Green Acres, it shouldn't matter who that property is transferred to. I strongly believe that.
And Representative Demmer to that, and then go back here, and I know Representative Junkie has some other stuff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to be clear. Am I allowed one transfer in total, or am I allowed one transfer for each parcel? Say, for example, if I've got 150 acres, and I want to do 50 of it to each of my three children. Do I get a transfer to each one of them because each parcel is one transfer, or do I only get one transfer and then the other?
Representative Junkie?
Again, we can straighten that out. Some of those transfers I'll take care of at once. When you're doing trusts and other things, they're all done at one time. You know, you've got a change in the trust ownership.
Before we jump to Senator Scoy, can you, Representative Junkie, can you recall the story Representative Hansen told us? He said his parents had the farm, and then how did that work?
It was trust. I mean, they had set up in trust, and when the parents die, now there's typically a filing and a transfer of ownership, but it's still the same people that own it, but now, you know, or the cousin bought the parents' share, but nothing's happened to the parcel. And what we're trying to get at is looking more at the parcel than the person. We're concerned about the parcel, not the person.
Okay, so Senator Scott.
Well, Madam Chair, this transfer issue is really only an issue for the 4 years of the grandfather. Because after that, this land is going to be conforming to a program. I mean, and if you're a farmer and you're farming your land and you're doing whatever you have to do to be
classified as 2A, then if somebody dies or they want to sell their land, they do that, and the new owner goes in and gets Green Acres. It's an issue of being in conforming parcels. And if you're in the conservation program, so your homestead, ag homestead, and we don't want to use non-productive, but the other one, 2B, then you're in there, and that's got a covenant on it, which is transferable with the land. If you want to sell it, you transfer the covenant. I mean, you guys are getting hung up on transferring when that shouldn't be an issue, because the parcels will be conforming. And so whoever the new landowner is just goes in and signs up for the program because he's a conforming parcel. I think that the transfer is...
Madam Chair, just to that point, yes, in your bill, that's true. We weren't looking at your bill.
You should have been.
This is the Arnold Zipper bill. So we're close. You're right. That's another way to handle it. But this would be another way to handle that besides the four-year grandfather where everyone now has to. This would allow someone to stay in at the same program beyond 4 years. If you're transferred once, if you sold your farm to me, I could stay in it for 20 years as long as the one transfer was allowed and I'd be there. So nothing would change.
Senator King.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate this chart because it is pretty, kind of lays it right out there. But I was a county commissioner in Chisago County, and you know, when I would go to the planning commission and somebody was going to be selling their farmland to a developer, you know, people would come and testify that, oh, no, I like seeing the cows out in the pasture. I like seeing his woods there. They like it all, but they're not paying for it. So one of the things that I think this highlights is that, you know, everybody likes driving out in the country and seeing the scenic beauty and everything, but they're not paying for it. This way, it shows they actually are paying for it.
Yes, that's exactly what the chart
is. But I mean, that is kind of nice to know because I've heard that so many times at the planning.
They're paying for it.
We're not, you know, I like seeing the cows there. You know, I don't want to see houses there. Well, you know, they're paying a portion of it.
Right. Yes. That's not my question. No. Anyone else? I do want to get one issue out before we, because we're kind of on a roll and we're making progress. I mean, to figure out a solution, everyone has to get their ideas out there and have the fight. And I think one thing we haven't hit on, and we need to spend a little time on, Senator Scoy, stop chuckling about County X, whatever it is. One thing I think we need to spend a little time on as a group here is thinking through the amount of phone calls we've all had and members who've said, you know, well, I want to keep this for the farmer. And who's the farmer? And I've heard the whole kind of gamut on how we do that from, you know, the OLA said let's not have an income limit, and that was because we didn't want, you know, to make farmers tell people their income. But Senator or Representative Junkie and others have said, well, that's one way to show they're farming. So how do we show they're farming? Is it an income limit? Is it a homestead? I mean, how are we going to show? That's what we have to get to here. Are we going to have people have to homestead? Are we going to have people have an income limit?
Right.
How are we going to show that they're actually farming? And I think as a group, we got to figure that out. So anybody in that sort of bucket should just jump in.
But again, Madam Chair, and we do understand that. And I think that's an important piece. This is about ag land. First of all, we have to understand this we're making it an ag preservation program. It's not a a development shelter your land till development program. It's not what it is. And so the first thing I want to mention before I get to that, Madam Chair, is the other issue that we have to straighten out too, which is the number of years. And frankly, I'm trying to wake Vandeveer and Old Scene up down there because this really pertains to you more than the rest of the state. And I know you're awake, Representative Vandeveer. We were both elected in 96.
Just waiting to get out of the credits and into the movie.
Yeah. One of the things we really have to seriously discuss, if you're serious about setting this aside and not being a shelter for the next Walmart or strip mall, then the length of years does make a difference. Because if Walmart, I'm using Walmart, it could be anyway, if some large box store is going to buy that property, a three-year payback is nothing. A five-year, seven-year is nothing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So you're really sheltering your land. So you have to talk about that length of time.
Representative Junkie, if I may.
Yeah, please. Because I know it affects, Frank, that you're the more highly developable, highly valued. When you look at this chart and see what your land values are compared to some other counties, this does affect you immensely.
And Senator Olstein, this is good, because we want to hear where you're at this, because I want to back up Representative Junkie here in that, you know, in the collar counties, the program is working to kind of be a speed dump on the way to development. If you look at the map, and this is what the Office of the Legislative Auditor said in the collar counties, you could argue that the farmers are not getting enough tax benefits and they should get significantly more because they're still ultimately developing. So if you look at kind of the land tracts in the seven counties and the collar counties, it's not stopping the lands from getting developed. It's just people are getting it until they ultimately sell or their kids sell or someone else sells. So, you know, we do need to figure that out. So, Senator Olstein, thoughts on...
Well, here's my spiel. I've done it many times. That in our neck of the state, say the average farm is a 160-acre farm. And because of the lie of the land, there may be 80 acres tillable, there may be a 40-acre wetland, and then there may be 40 acres of high woods. So only half the farm may be productive land. But the thing that I've liked more about Rod's proposal with the Conservation Conservancy as this goes on is they would keep the productive land in Green Acres, and then they could put the rest of it into this conservation covenant. You know, then they're setting it aside. You know, and the nice part about this is that if they decide, well, we're going to sell the land in a couple of years, well, then they can pull it out of Green Acres with no payback. But if they say it's a century farm, we're going to keep it in the family, they put it in the covenant, and then...
Okay, so Senator Olstein just got a big reaction from the House conference there, because I think that proves the point that it's not going to stop them from selling it when they want to and developing it. And then public tax dollars have gone in this mechanism, and it's only slowed it down so they're ready to develop it. Which the point is that it's not supposed to develop. Senator Olstein.
But that eight-year covenant makes a difference, because at this point they can decide, well, geez, are we going to keep it in the family or not? But if they're going to, then they sign up for the covenant, and it's at least 8 years. It's ongoing beyond that.
Senator Scoy, and you know, Representative Junkie or anyone else can jump in here, but I think that works on the covenant land, but doesn't work on the ag land, and they still sell. So, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'll just give you my rationale from last year, from the 3 years. And it's pretty simple. Is these guys, these landowners, are all mostly farmers, and they probably haven't lived very well, and the only thing they had for an asset was their land. And I thought, what the heck, when they finally got to sell it, why penalize? And I just said 3 years. And I didn't see any reason to make any change from what they signed up for 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Well, Representative Junkie or Coonan, help me out here. I thought we were talking about folks going forward, not people currently in, but going forward. And I think that's what we're arguing for longer years.
Well, Madam Chair, I think we need to resolve fundamentally if we're going to treat Minnesotans differently. And I don't think we should. I really don't think we should. If somebody owns land that meets the criteria, and they happen to be in Beltrami County or in Dante, why should we treat them differently? I can't see why we should.
Senator Vanderveer.
Madam Chair, I view it a little differently. I don't view it as this costing us money. We have many classes, some we favor, some we don't. This is a favorite class that we're allowing them to choose to be in, granted. But other than that, it's no different than homestead or other things that we do. If we want to encourage and make available farmland, especially from my standpoint in the metro area, if we want to protect that way of life and allow them to stay in business until they decide to get out of it, then there's no way they can pay the tax on it as if it was residential or something else. So what this allows is them to continue their business until they decide to sell it. I don't look at it as getting this money back being a requirement any more than we go back and chase people when they sell their house and try and get their homestead credit back. We want to encourage people to own their own home. In the same way, we want to encourage this land to remain in agricultural use if it's in agricultural use, because we benefit from the open space, we benefit from the access that we have to it, you know, to go out and ride horses or do whatever we want to do. And we get the benefit of the, you know, the green space and all that. So it's, you know, there's benefits to it, but really it's protecting that way of life. They cannot function if we take away this tax this lower tax rate, they're simply going to have to sell it.
Well, you know, when we go, a lot of people go back to, you have to live up to the intent of the contract they signed. But the intent of that law that was signed back in the 1960s was ag preservation. And I don't think you can compare it to a homestead house, because I can't sell my homestead house for 60 or 100 or 1,000 times what the land is worth. I mean, that's what Representative Junkie was saying, and I even saw it near Dilworth where a Walmart came in and they sold, it was like $100,000-$200,000 per acre. It was just huge. Amount, and that's what's happening, especially in
New York. To that point, Madam Chair. You know, we're not buying this house. It's $100 a year shift on a $200,000 property, maybe. You're not buying it. You're getting your way for a while with it. The state is by preferring this plan. If you want to buy this land and keep it a certain way, go, feel free to do that. But this isn't, we're not buying it from these people. And so why act like we, they have to pay it back or like we did buy it? We're just encouraging that use. And that's a little bit different than saying, well, you know, the homestead is a preferred class. We've decided that we want that to continue, so we have a lower rate on it. Isn't that correct? And don't we do that in a number of other things? And to me, this is just a lower class. If you want to buy it, buy it. That's a different deal.
Well, yeah, the homestead, I still don't think, I mean, it's not the correct comparison, but well, I mean, the bottom line is, how do you balance from ag preservation to, as Representative Junkie said, a shelter until you can develop it for millions of dollars? I mean, and that's the crux, I think, of the question. How do you balance that? And with 3 years of back taxes, I mean, is that really a penalty if you're able to sell that property for a huge amount?
You're just
Senator,
I'm not worried that someone's going to sell. They're going to sell their property eventually, unless the state buys it. And we see, we're buying up most of the land that we get our hands on. But you know, they are going to eventually sell it. There's nothing you can do. And the question is, do you want farming to continue in the suburban rings? And in different parts of the state. If you do, you have to give them the tax break. If we take this all away, you're not going to have to worry about them selling. They're going to lose it to the bank, or they will sell it, and because they can't farm it. Not when the taxes are more than the payment usually. So I don't see where you're giving them anything per se, other than telling them you'll tax them at this lower rate. I don't see why you feel you're losing something.
I mean, no one's suggesting we're taking away the Green Acres program. I mean, that's not what we're talking about here. But I think it's a very legitimate question in how do you balance the original intent of the law, which is ag preservation. And granted, you might argue, even though in the Wink Collar counties that you've lost a lot of ag land, you might have lost a lot more had it not been for Green Acres. I will say that. I think you're probably right, but we're still losing that land, and how do you kind of balance that? And maybe what Representative or Senator Scoy has, the conservation, that's one approach you could use, but I just think that payback period and covenants might all play into it also.
Sometimes.
Madam Chair, just to change the subject slightly again and put something else on the table, according to the following up with what Senator Olstein and Scoy are talking about, the conservation plan, one of the other issues there, putting my appraiser / assessor type hat back on, in your bill, it says that you value that land. The bill says market value, excluding development pressure, et cetera, limited to tillable land. But the problem with that is, how do you come up with that value? We don't have a methodology developed for that. And again, we're confusing assessors again. There's no agreement on how to value that for non-productive land. So now, again, you haven't taken care of that totally. And I know that's a technical kind of question, but that is one of the problems when we go in the conservation plan. There's no methodology that assessors currently would have to value that land, even based on the language you put there. So, I mean, it's something we have to work on between today and tomorrow, and I just want to put that on the table so that people are aware of that going forward.
I'm going to go to Representative Demmer here and then Senator Scoy, but I think we're it seems like we're going backward, but we're actually not. We're going forward because, and we're going to try to adjourn pretty quickly here, but people have to put out why that what they disagree, and everybody's doing that, so that's good. Right. We can't forget that we agree on a lot of stuff here, or it's very close. So we do, Senator Bach and I want to get this bill wrapped up tomorrow. So that means that everybody who's got, you know, input needs to be talking and finding each other, and, you know, we're doing everything in public, on the tape, but, you know, time is of the essence because it's Thursday night, tomorrow night, so, and Senator Bach will have the gavel, but we want to go to everybody else who has something to say here before we try to wrap up. Representative Demmer.
Just to that point, Madam Chair, Representative Junkie talked about this. I did have in my bill, did call for the Department of Revenue to come up with a methodology for valuing, for coming up with green acres value on the grandfathered rural vacant land. There is a methodology right now. It's arbitrary. It's a percentage of something or other. But just to throw that out, I think that is it's a good point. I just want to get on record. I think it's important that we come up with something. You know, they and I don't know if the Department of Revenue has all the smarts, but they got more than I got. I know that. So in my bill, I basically said that I charged the Department of Revenue to come up with some sort of a plan, like they did with the ag lands, for saying what is that green acres valuation on the rural vacant. And I think it's important that we do come up with something in that regard.
Thank you, Representative Demers.
Well, the value of the 2B land would be the value prescribed by the Commissioner of Revenue for Class 2A. So it's what it is. And then what we do is, because I think ag land has a range of values, we go down to the bottom and determining the value for ad valorem tax purposes shall not consider the presence of commercial, industrial, residential, seasonal, recreational land uses that may affect the value of the real estate defined in subdivision A. I think that ag value has separate, differing values depending upon where it is on the farm, and I wanted to give this language in there so the assessor could have determined a range. And I don't have the last engrossment, but I think it says no greater than. So it's the value of the class 2A total.
Right. And no, I understand that, but I mean, there's all those other factors. I think we're setting up, but I'm not sitting here. So I want the assessors to weigh in on this, too, if it's clear how they're going to value this, because that's one of the problems we had with the old bill was the assessors and not being clear enough on what the law was and how they implement it. So I'm just putting out mainly for them, too, to weigh in before tomorrow on how your conservation fees would be able to be valued very clearly and by formula or some way, like Representative Demmer just said, that there's got to be a real... Yours, you list all the reasons and the different ways it could be valued. You list a range, but again, you're setting this up for interpretation differently by different folks.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think for 90% or more of the ag land, we could just use the 2A towable property.
Right.
Because, as I said earlier, the policy fits just fine. Now, when you get inside to this collar suburbs or area, you are going to have some of the low-value, non-tillable lands that's going to have a significantly lower value than the ag land. And I thought that we should give them a mechanism to establish a range of values so if it was all swamp or something, they could actually put a little lower value on that than the 2A tillable property. And that's kind of a hard thing to write out in words, but that's right. What we were headed for.
Well, I think your intent is good, but again, it's just something we need to make sure we're clear on tomorrow going ahead with this bill.
Okay, we're into the wrap-up now. Does anybody have anything else they want to throw out there? Because this is good. We've got all the conferees sort of weighing in. Anybody else want to throw anything out so we can all dream about Green Acres? Anybody? Nobody. That's good. Okay, so why don't we... I'm just going to read this note here for a minute. Okay, so I think we want to hear what Senator Bach thinks about tomorrow. This is a bad time for everybody because we're all at policy deadlines and all the committee rooms are full. We have a sense of need. So, members, we want to hear from Senator Bach a little bit so everyone in the room can just kind of get a feeling for where we're going tomorrow. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, the Senate recently passed new rules, joint rules, that the House, I believe, has not taken up yet. The new rules, when they're passed by the House, will require rotation of gavel and conference committees every day, excluding Sunday and holidays. The old rules don't talk about that. So I just can tell you, I guess I'm going to get the gavel. And if people want to get serious and resolve this, I'm willing to do that. If not, Senator Cohen will probably be happy because I'm not going to spend $15 million in this biennium. And frankly, I don't feel a strong desire to do anything on Green Acres. I mean, I thought we did pretty good work last year. So I guess it doesn't matter to me. We're spending a lot of time talking about a bunch of stuff that's not in the bill, that stuff that's not even been introduced, bills that have been introduced and never heard anywhere. And, Madam Chair, tomorrow night I'm going home. And I'm going to spend the weekend with my family, and I'm not going to call a meeting tomorrow and still be sitting here at 7:30 tomorrow night playing footsie with people.
Okay?
Straight up. So if people between now and tomorrow morning want to decide if they want to meet tomorrow, I'm willing to meet tomorrow if we're going to do something constructive. If we're not, then let's all go home, and people can think about over the weekend whether they want to do anything on conformity, if they want to do anything on Green Acres. I don't have a strong feeling either way. Be nice if we could, but if we can't get there, well, the world's not going to end. Senator Cohen will be happy, and Senator Cohen's my good friend. And we're $15 million means something right now. So that's just kind of where we're at, Madam Chair. So people that are having all this discussion back and forth, I want to continue to have that later tonight and early tomorrow morning. People want to get it done maybe in an hour and a half, 2 hours tomorrow. I'm willing to meet tomorrow afternoon to do that. We post a meeting tomorrow morning sometime, but I think people need to sleep on whether they really want to get some work done or not. And if they do, I'm willing to meet tomorrow afternoon. I think we can probably get room 118 over in the Capitol. I think we can probably get it about 4 o'clock. If people are interested in doing that. So I think maybe over the course of the night, people can figure out if they're interested in doing that or not. But I do have plans for the weekend with my family, and it involves going home tomorrow night. So.
Well, I appreciate knowing where you're at, Senator Bach. I guess I'd ask the Conservatives as a group, does everyone think they can work out Green Acres in a couple hours tomorrow? I mean, I think we know our colleagues want us to. That means the grand compromise must take place quickly. I think we had a good discussion so people can understand each other, but everyone's got to give here now. I mean, everyone's got to give here now, or as Senator Bach just said, it's okay with the 2008 change.
I'm sure.
So I think people got to get motivated. Senator
Holstein. Actually, I think that you're right, that we are closer than it appears.
Yep.
So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you. Others? Does everybody think this is doable in a couple hours tomorrow?
We're really close.
Compromise means everybody has to give something up. That's what a compromise is. Okay, so anything else? We're going to look for Mr. Lundquist or Ms. Albrecht's email telling us when we're room and time. Looks like maybe about 4-ish. And so with that, thank you, everybody. We got through everything, and we are adjourned.